It's time for the Scott Rintoul Show.
He holds, he shoots, he scores!
Where the West...
Pettersson off the left wing, steps into a slap shot and scores. Elias Pettersson, oh my word, again.
...is one.
Rebound, Kachuk scores! What a night for Matthew Kachuk.
Let's make it happen. Everything you've got, no excuses.
Jackson avoids, spins, he's in. Touchdown, McCaffrey leaps.
Now, here's Scott Rintoul.
Pull my trigger, let me blow your mind.
What's going on? How's your Wednesday? We'll get you through it. We'll get you through hump day here. If you got any midweek doldrums, we're here to iron them out for you. Scott Rintoul with you. Jamie Dodd, you'll hear him throughout the course of the show. It's Wednesday. That means Judge Jamie is coming your way in 15 minutes' time. He'll put a couple of high-profile cases on trial during the course of that segment. We do it every single Wednesday. Want your feedback? You've got the text message inbox number. You've got the fan feedback line. Hit us up. After a very busy night on ice, a lot of different stories, some that were surprising, like the Leafs giving up 5 goals in the final 10 minutes of a 6-1 loss. The Vancouver Canucks looking like they were going to blow out the Ottawa Senators and then kind of hanging on for, if you didn't see it, what looks like a pretty easy 5-2 win. Didn't feel that way in the building last night when they put Alex Burrows in the Ring of Honor. There's a coach fired in the NHL. There's a coach fired in the NFL. We're going to get to all of that, and we're also going to talk prospects this morning, Canada style. World Junior Selection Camp. The names came out. Sam Cosentino, he's all over this. We'll talk about what this year's team is going to look like, the identity. We'll also talk about his latest prospect rankings as well a little bit later on in the program. But as we have often done over the course of the last week and a half, we are forced to begin. I guess we're not forced to, but we choose to, because it is the biggest topic right now in hockey, and it has become the biggest talking point around sports in this country. The conversation, the one that continues about where we're at as far as coaches go, certain situations in particular, like the one surrounding Bill Peters, who's been dismissed but is still under investigation. Daniel Carcillo has been speaking. There are allegations against Mark Crawford. It's messy, it's murky, and I know it's a difficult slog day in, day out, but it's an important conversation, which is why we're going to continue to have it. Hakeem Aliyu, he has now met with the NHL. He spoke for the first time yesterday since we knew that he was going to talk to the NHL. We've seen him talk to various reporters, but he hasn't gone on camera, hasn't gone in front of microphones. Here's what he had to say upon leaving the NHL head office.
Yeah, I wanted to start with just thanking everyone for their support. It obviously means a lot to me. It's been a tough week, but we had some great discussion with Gary and Bill. They couldn't have been kinder and receptive to the message that we're trying to bring. And I think there's just some big change coming, and it's long overdue, and I'm excited to see it come to fruition. So just wanted to thank you guys for, obviously it's cold out here, and being out here, and like I said, I appreciate all your guys' support and for you guys being here.
That was in New York yesterday afternoon. The words that most people are hanging on from that clip from Hakeem Aliyu, who has told his story, he's shared his insight. He has, I would assume, put forth some suggestions, some recommendations of changes he'd like to see. But what you heard in that quote was, I think there's some big change coming. Now, what that is and what that is tangibly, I'm not sure. We're all waiting to find out. Does that mean big change at the National Hockey League level? Does that mean big change in minor hockey, Hockey Canada, junior hockey? What does that constitute? But he seemed very optimistic after that meeting that there is change that's going to come of this. And what those substantive changes are, anybody's guess at this point. There are a lot of feet that are being held to the fire right now. There is a demand for change. There are some that resist it. I'm not sure what they're worried about. I'm not sure what they're scared of. But this is an ongoing conversation, and one that has been embraced by many a former player. Some have not wanted to go down this road. Some have stories to tell, and they are eager to get these out because, hey, you can choose what you think the motivation is. That's up to you. You can decide for yourself. Maybe you think it's an axe to grind. Maybe you think it's because they want to impact change moving forward. You can hear these quotes. You can listen for yourself. But it's not just Bill Peters and Mike Babcock anymore. Mark Crawford is on leave from the Chicago Blackhawks. He was the coach when Colorado won the Stanley Cup with Vancouver for many years, oversaw the West Coast Express era. We know that he's coached in L.A., Ottawa. Now with Chicago, Harold Druckan, a guy who didn't play very long in the National Hockey League, but one that is remembered in Vancouver because he scored a couple of really big goals. He scored a couple of big goals that put the Canucks back in the playoffs for the first time this century. But Harold Druckan did not have a good experience with Mark Crawford by his admission and shared that publicly yesterday in Newfoundland. Here's what he had to say.
Mark Crawford, hands down the worst human being I've ever met. I actually put it on my Facebook this morning that I wouldn't let him coach my dog. He's that bad. He's physically, verbally, you name it, any type of abuse that he could come up with to ride a young 20-year-old to his success, that's what he used to do. Being called a dumb Newfie or a stupid Newfie, or he's going to send me back on the boats in Newfoundland. That's just as offensive to me as it is being called something that derogatory. He'd do that. He'd do it in public. He'd do it in front of all the brass. He'd kick you in the back. He'd grab you by the shirt and pull you back so you choke. He was absolutely ridiculous.
And so Harold Druckan, I imagine, is going to be in conversation with the Blackhawks, the NHL, however this investigation goes. Those are some fairly inflammatory accusations. And there are certain things that Harold Druckan said during the course of that clip that maybe to you don't seem like a big deal. They certainly are a big deal to him. Obviously, there is a difference between the verbal abuse and the derisive comments that Harold Druckan described and the physical ones that he just alleged as well. We'll see where this goes, and we'll see what other players have to say on this subject as well. Kevin Bieksa was a teammate of Harold. Actually, I don't know if he played with Harold Druckan, but he certainly played for Mark Crawford. I think they must have just missed each other in Vancouver. But Kevin Bieksa, he's on Hockey Night in Canada now. He has not shied away from this conversation. He was on Tim and Sid yesterday, had a lot of different things that were interesting talking points, including this, where when he broke into the league, Mark Crawford was his head coach. And just so you know the context of all of this, Sid Sixero opened the topic of the conversation that's ongoing. He didn't direct it in any way. And Kevin Bieksa said, well, let's just dive into Mark Crawford because that's what everybody's talking about. He talked about how he was never physically abused or had any type of physical altercation with Mark Crawford. He said he never saw it. But then this was a very interesting comment from Kevin Bieksa, and it's an honest one as well, about if he saw it, if a teammate had been struck, what would he have done?
If I would have seen him do it to somebody else, I probably would have thought, and keep in mind, I was a rookie back then.
Right.
You know, kept my mouth shut for a few years and just did what I was told. And I probably would have thought in my head, wow, like he just kicked that guy. I hope he doesn't do it to me. But I probably wouldn't have said anything or spoke out. No, it would have been something I wasn't happy about, but it wouldn't have been so outrageous that I would have felt like I needed to say something.
And that's basically a clip telling you how different the climate was then compared to the one that we find ourselves in right now. That's how different it was when Kevin Bieksa broke in the early to mid 2000s. That happens today. Somebody's going to talk about it, and it's a different type of empowerment. But this is Kevin Bieksa being honest, saying, I probably wouldn't have done anything. I wouldn't have liked it. I would hope it wasn't going to happen to me, but I'm a rookie, so I would have fallen in line. And if anybody watched his career, and I think most of you did, not much scared Kevin Bieksa, not really afraid of anything, but we're talking about a hockey culture that, and this isn't to label everybody who's ever been in the game or everything that's ever happened in the game, but we're talking about a hockey culture where these types of stories were swept under the rug. They weren't talked about. It's just the way it was is the tagline that you hear a lot. And it's the truth. Here we are years later. We have a different standard. And this will be part of the conversation going forward as well. How do we apply what we know now to the time it was back then? People can admit they're wrong. Alex Burrows is a good example of this yesterday. Alex Burrows went into the Ring of Honor in Vancouver. Alex Burrows said some things on the ice, did some things on the ice that crossed the line. Here in 2019, and if you go back a few years, 2015, in fact, is where Alex Burrows was called on it publicly, asked about it by reporters, and he said, I crossed the line. I wouldn't do that now. I've changed. Here's why I did it. I'm not saying it's okay, but I've changed. And that's part of this conversation as well. Accountability, making reparations. Daniel Carcillo, if you are on social media, you know he has been extremely outspoken on this. He has put forth his platform to those who have encountered any type of verbal, physical abuse of any kind throughout their career, anything that has impacted a young hockey player's life. And he said, look, you can talk to me. I'm happy to be the conduit for you. You want to share your story? We can do that. If you don't, just let you know I'm a resource. We all remember how Daniel Carcillo played the game. His nickname is Carbomb. There's a reason for that. He was chaos on ice. He would do anything and everything. He crossed the line multiple times. And he has admitted publicly that he was abusive. He was a bully. He was homophobic. But he also says part of the reason he's sharing that is because he wants the culture to change. He was on Fan 90 this morning with the starting lineup there, and Ashley Docking asked him about his public admission of what he was compared to what he is now.
I've been saying that for days. I've said that several times. I've said it several times over the last year mm-hmm. of advocating. Just people don't seem to want to listen. And I said that because I'm guilty of it, right? I'm guilty of being, of falling into that system of the programming that has gone on. And I'm ashamed of the person that I was. There's a reason that I keep the car bomb boom handle on Twitter, because it reminds me of who I was and it reminds me of what I never want to be again. And at 25 years old, I changed my life mm-hmm. in the NHL, right? I went to rehab. I got rehabilitated. I was held accountable by the league. So why can't we reach back and hold these coaches accountable? I don't understand why people are so agitated by it.
People are agitated by it because, based on what I've received as far as text messages go, and please send them my way. Subway text line, you've got that. You've got the fan feedback line as well. People are agitated by it because they don't want to face these stories. They want to leave them in the past. They think that there's no point in pulling skeletons out of everybody's closet. And while it's very fair, and I've said this time and time again, none of us is perfect. None of us. We've all made mistakes to varying degrees. Daniel Carcillo is talking about confronting those, being accountable for those. We can agree, disagree, debate, have a conversation about what the consequences are for them. In some cases, it may simply be an apology. It may be therapy in other cases. It may be advocacy in other cases. There are a lot of different ways this conversation goes. I'm not sure why people are so afraid of the consequences, but I would ask you this as we continue this conversation. For all of those who say, just let it be in the past, no big deal, what's done is done, let's move on, why are these guys bringing this up years later? I would ask you this. What if it was your son? What if it was your daughter? If your son came to you at 25, 31, name your age, and said, this is what happened to me when I played hockey at whatever level, and here's how it's messed up my life to a certain degree. What would you do as a parent? What would you do as a brother? What would you do as a close friend? You would advocate for that person. I'm not sure what you would ask for. That's up to you, and it depends on every individual situation. But that's my response to anybody who says, why now? Why are these people bringing it up? How would you feel if you were in those shoes? How would you feel if that was a family member? We'll continue this conversation, but we will turn this show into other things many of them about the sports that happened last night, also over the last few days. We're going to talk World Junior Hockey with Sam Cosentino in 20 minutes. But first, what we do every single Wednesday, it's Judge Jamie.
You are about to enter the courtroom of Judge Jamie Dodd. The athletes are real. The cases are real. The rulings are final. This is Judge Jamie.
He is trained as a lawyer. He has worked for a firm. And now he is the producer of this fine program. He is Jamie Dodd. And he is Judge Jamie. What cases are on the docket today, sir?
So we're going to do something a little different. Normally, I'm all about rendering a guilty or an innocent verdict. I'm all about assigning blame. But this is a special edition of Judge Jamie. This is divorce court, Judge Jamie. And when you have a divorce, no, there's not necessarily one party who's at fault. And there's a big divorce that is in the early stages of taking place here in the NHL. It is, of course, the New Jersey Devils and Taylor Hall. I think it's pretty clear that a separation is coming.
Yeah, that's coming. And you hope it's an amicable one.
Exactly. And that's what I'm here to try to arrange today. I'm not going to say the Devils screwed up or Taylor Hall screwed up. This was a beautiful relationship. This was something that a lot of people thought was going to last for a long time.
It resulted in a Hart Trophy.
He won the Hart Trophy there. But we've seen the cracks start to form. It's time to move on. So I'm not going to assign blame, but what I'm going to try to do is I'm going to find an amicable solution here. And the key question in a situation like this is, what do both parties want? What are their goals? What do they hope to accomplish? Now, the good thing is we know what Taylor Hall wants. He's been quite vocal about that. He wants to go to a team that has a chance to consistently make the playoffs. That's his goal. That's great. The question from the Devil's side is a little more interesting. What do they want? Because remember, they went in pretty hard this offseason. They went out and they got PK Subban. Yeah, they have a young team, but they were making noise like, hey, we think we're going to be a lot better this year.
Signed Wayne Simmons.
Exactly. Do they have the appetite for a full-scale rebuild of some sort, or are they looking to turn this around? No, we want to get a contributing player right now for Taylor Hall and make a push as soon as possible. That's something they're going to have to decide. And it changes the possible destinations for Taylor Hall. We've heard a lot about the potential of a Taylor Hall for Johnny Gaudreau swap. And if they aren't interested in a rebuild, yeah, maybe that makes sense. But I think they need to just have a little bit more patience. If I was counseling the New Jersey Devils, and I'm not saying just trade him for, you know, a 2023 first-round pick. No, that's not what I'm talking about. But just a little more patience than chasing Johnny Gaudreau. And I do think there's a match here that makes sense for both parties. It's not one that we've heard yet. We've heard Arizona as a dark horse. Of course, we've heard Edmonton and Calgary.
Colorado.
Colorado makes a lot of sense. I'm not ruling that one out at all. But I'm looking at the Nashville Predators. This is a team kind of stuck in the doldrums, but we know they have a culture of sustained success in Nashville. They're in the playoffs every year. They haven't gotten to where they want to go in the playoffs, but they're there every year, and you can sell Taylor Hall on the idea that he's going to be in the postseason consistently. Now, there's a couple of different ways you can go with this deal. They got a prospect playing down in the AHL that people are very high on, Elli Tolvanen. People think he could come in and step up and contribute right away. He's probably going to be the centerpiece. I'm also looking at Kyle Turris. Kyle Turris, only 30 years old, not a good contract, not at all. And Nashville would have to give up a little extra if they want to ship him out. But if New Jersey wants to kind of split the difference here, get some futures, and get a guy who can still contribute at this level, Kyle Turris might be someone they take a look at. His numbers are not so bad that he should be out of the league at this point. So if you build something around Tolvanen, Kyle Turris, maybe if you get really aggressive, you can try to ask about Dante Fabro, but I don't think that's a road the Predators are going to go down. I think there's a fit there. And I think both parties can walk away from this, heads held high, happy.
Ray Shiro, I wonder if he's on Hockey Tinder right now, checking his options, saying, yeah, I'd swipe left on that. No, not so much. I'll swipe right on that one, whatever it is. I've never been on Tinder, but this is what the kids talk about.
Neither of us have ever been on Tinder.
No, that's what happens when you're married for quite some time, like the two of us, and that's a great thing. Ray Shiro wanted to be married to Taylor Hall. It's not going to happen. He's going to go a separate way. I understand why you're pitching Nashville. I don't know that they've got the right assets. If you're taking Kyle Turris back, who can still be a productive player in this league, but at the type of cap hit and term he's got left, he's still got a lot. He's still got another 4 years after this one at $6 million a year. So the kicker's going to have to be big.
Yep.
So there has to be a first-round pick. If I'm the Devils, I'm also saying, okay, Juuse Saros, we haven't figured out our goaltending yet. There have been times we like Mackenzie Blackwood. Corey Schneider hasn't worked out. So I want a cheap goalie who's young coming back as well. You're asking for a really big package if Kyle Turris is coming out. And to make it work in Nashville, they'd have to move out some money. They couldn't just sit on the books and say, I will add Taylor Hall to this mix. I'm not sure I see the fit for that reason. Eli Tolvanen, opinions have changed a little bit.
Yep.
2 years ago, people really liked him. That's dipped. People thought he'd be at the NHL level at this point in time. Certainly could work out. I understand why you're putting that forward. I don't know that he's going to end up there. I think they'd like to make it work. I think it makes sense on the surface. Hey, here's a team that needs a boost, although the boost they need is keeping pucks out of their own net.
That's true.
They've scored a lot. Like, offense has not been a problem for the Predators. They need defense, which is also what New Jersey needs. Colorado, to me, still makes the most sense. I don't know if Arizona has enough in their system, but you're right. That divorce is going to happen at some point in time. Colorado has a lot of prospects.
And Colorado has a lot of cap space.
I can't see Colorado trading Bowen Byram just based on Joe Sakic's history, but that's my ask if I'm New Jersey. That's what I'm talking about. You bring in Ty Smith and you add Bowen Byram, a couple of guys who are going to be on the World Junior team this year. That's where, and Ty Smith's already, by the way, in New Jersey system. It's not like you'd have to acquire him, but that's my ask. I want a young defenseman coming back if I'm talking Colorado. I don't know if they can get it done. I don't know if they can make that work, but Colorado still on the surface makes the most sense to me.
And Colorado is in that perfect position where they're so young, but they're also in win now mode. And they have one of the most exciting young lineups in the NHL. Okay, we've just got a few seconds here. There's another minor case we should address, and it's the Houston Rockets against the NBA. If you saw this last night, James Harden dunked the basketball, and it was ruled not a basket because the refs got confused about what happened. Rockets went on to lose in overtime. I'll keep this really short. You gotta replay the final 8 minutes of that game from when the missed basket was called. There's precedent for it in the NBA.
They went to double overtime, Jamie.
It's weird. I don't care. You gotta replay it. You missed a basket. You can't miss a basket in the NBA. That's it. Case dismissed.
We will definitely revisit that conversation. We didn't leave you enough time in divorce court this morning, so we'll get back to that conversation, but we got to make way for this one. Canada's World Junior Team, they're going to form it this month. The selection camp has been unveiled. We'll get Sam Cosentino's impressions of what Canada's identity will be at this year's World Junior Tournament next on the Scott Rintoul Show.
Now more of the Scott Rintoul Show.
What will be the identity of this year's World Junior Team? As far as Canada's entry goes, it's a question I'm going to put to Sam Cosentino when he joins me in just a couple of minutes' time. They're going to be expected to be good, we know that, but there are different types of Team Canada entries. There are high-skill entries. There are the workmanlike entries that we put in that have a high level of skill but not relative to some of the other years that we put out, that they're going to be four lines that look relatively the same. What's the identity of this year's team to Sam Cosentino? List hasn't been whittled down completely, but they're going to begin that process starting on Monday. World Junior Selection Camp opens in Oakville, Ontario at that point in time. Scott Rintoul with you. Thanks for joining us. Thanks for getting in on the conversation as well. There's some really good texts coming in, some that we're going to address as this program continues. Busy night on ice last night. Much needed win for the Montreal Canadiens. We talked about that with Eric Engels yesterday, and I can only imagine the weight of the world that came off of that team and that dressing room by getting a 4-2 win against a quality team. We often say this in sports, that you see the makings of the slump buster before it actually occurs. And that is basically what transpired for the Montreal Canadiens over the weekend. They played two games where they were better. They were better against the Flyers on Saturday. They were better against the Bruins on Sunday, but it wasn't enough to get the win. Well, it translated last night. They got the 4-2 victory. They took care of a team that hasn't lost a whole lot, the New York Islanders. That slump is over. Now let's see if they can get themselves on a winning streak. I'm not sure I've seen a team this year as streaky as the Dallas Stars. Looked like they could never win a game to begin the season. We talked about the big hole they were in. We talked about Jim Montgomery coming out as they started to get things turned around and call out a couple of his stars in Jamie Benn and Tyler Seguin. And then they rolled through Western Canada. It looked like they'd never lose again. And now they've lost four in a row again. They are either winning a bunch or losing a bunch right now. And they lost yesterday. Going to give you the numbers on Patrick Laine. Dude loves to play the Dallas Stars. If Winnipeg is able to continue this story, which has been a great one, I am shocked that the Winnipeg Jets are where they are right now. Credit to them. We went into this season thinking big hole on the blue line, like massive gaping black hole on the blue line with no Tyler Myers, no Jacob Trouba. Dustin Byfuglien was a surprise that caught everybody off guard. Ben Chiarot was out as well. Who's even going to play defense for this team? Oh, yeah, they got Neil Pionk in that deal with the Rangers. They're going to hemorrhage goals. I do remember having the conversation going into the season, however, that if Connor Hellebuyck turned things back to what we saw 2 years ago, if he looked like the guy who was nominated for a Vezina the year the Jets made the run to the Western Conference Final, that could erase some of the problems. Boy, is it ever. And they're scoring a bunch. Things are good in Winnipeg right now. Can they sustain it? Million-dollar question, a multi-million-dollar one. Do they get Dustin Byfuglien back? Imagine if this team can keep this up right now and then they get Dustin Byfuglien back at some point during the year, if they can iron out the differences, if he still wants to play hockey. What an add that would be partway through this season for the Winnipeg Jets. And as mentioned, they beat a Stars team that looked like it would never lose again and all of a sudden has lost four in a row. Canucks got a little healthier last night. Antoine Roussel came back. That was a big moment on Alex Burrow's night in Vancouver. Sharks lost to the Capitals. John Carlson. We talked about him a lot when he was leading the scoring race. He's not leading it anymore, but he's sixth in NHL scoring. More details on John Carlson's great start and where it fits in the history of the National Hockey League among blue liners. Spoiler, it's right up there. It's right up there with some of the best ever. We'll continue that conversation. And the ones you want to chime in on as well, as mentioned, we're getting some great texts this morning, and I want to dive into that conversation, but I got to make way for this one. A guy who saw John Carlson at the World Juniors when he was scoring an overtime-winning goal for the U.S. in a gold medal game, and he's seen all of these youngsters come up and make their way into the National Hockey League. Sam Cosentino of Sportsnet joins me now to talk some World Junior hockey and go beyond that with his latest rankings. How are you doing this morning, Sam?
Yeah, doing great, Scott. Thanks for having me on. Pretty exciting time of year for somebody like myself with the World Juniors, and you know, looking forward to a good second half of the season too, to see how things shake out with all these draft eligible guys.
No question about it, and I don't think you and I can avoid the conversation. It's the biggest one going in hockey right now, and I think it's an important one. So before I get into Canada's World Junior entry, we're seeing this at an NHL level with everything that's gone on with Bill Peters and the stories about Mike Babcock, Mark Crawford right now. Tom Rennie came out when they unveiled the roster, and he said, we need to be better as Hockey Canada. Do you see any type of seismic change coming as far as minor hockey is concerned and the umbrella that Canada hockey oversees?
You know what? And that's a really interesting question. I think what we're going to see and is probably an extended level of what we're already seeing in terms of coaches, even at the minor hockey level, being vetted. So, you know, as an example, I coach my 6-year-old T-ball in the summertime. And, in order to be able to do that, I have to go through a criminal background check and I have to go through a police check, and I'm not allowed to be active as part of an active member of the staff unless I go through those things. I think that can be extended a bit further. And I think when it comes to coaching development programs, which are oftentimes the requirement as we get into the higher levels of coaching, there's going to be part of that curriculum you'll probably see be changed to add some of how to deal with certain situations, the mental health aspect, identifying players that, you know, may need a hug or may need that hard, tough love. I think that'll become more part of the program as opposed to just, hey, X's and O's, here's what we do. Here's what we're doing systematically. Here's what we do to organize a practice, so on and so forth. I think a little bit more of that is going to be directed towards how we're dealing with our people, you know, off the ice and away from the rink.
That's a big part of this solution, isn't it, Sam? Giving people resources, and that's something that I'm not saying it's Hockey Canada's fault, but maybe that has been part of the problem all along, that we make the assumption that those who get into coaching and have been able to win games, that they are adequately equipped to deal with all of the situations that arise, and we're finding out now they're not.
Well, you know what, Scott? I spent 12 years working with the Toronto Blue Jays in an assistant equipment manager capacity and a bat boy capacity, and what I could tell you about my experience at that level of sport is that it really is a microcosm of life. And through my 12 years, I experienced people that abused their spouses. I experienced people that were alcoholics, drug addicts, people that were racist, people that were generally not good people. Having said that, the flip side of that, 90% of the people that I came across through my 12 years were actually really good people. And I still think that exists in the game of hockey. We're seeing a bit of an overcorrection right now because of the incidents that have come to light. But having said all that, when it comes to hockey and some of the things we've seen, you're right. What is to say that because this guy simply has the title as coach, or female has the title of coach, does that make them qualified as a person to deal with things that aren't necessarily X's and O's and those types of things? What I will also say and speak to this matter is I think the CHL and in general, the three member leagues, the Quebec League, the Ontario League, and Western Hockey League, have done an excellent job in identifying some of that in recent years. Back when I first started calling games 20 years ago, the players didn't have anywhere near the resources afforded to them as they have now. Each of these teams and the league in and of itself provides outlet for mental health services, for sports psychology, for giving them an outlet to say, you know what, I don't really like how this guy's dealing with me as a coach and as a player, so on and so forth. And I also think that our kids are more educated in that regard, where they don't feel as guarded to say, oh, if I go say something about the coach, well, I'm going to lose my minutes on the power play. I think we've had that reckoning as for me has already started. And I think our junior leagues are doing a really good job in that regard. And I think that should be noted.
Do you think it's going to be a similar example to the way hazing wasn't completely eradicated but has been diminished substantially?
Yeah, no question. I mean, there are certain things that I think you still need to have within a team framework. And not to say that there's tiers or whatever else, but I know when I played baseball in college in Michigan back in the 90s, yeah, I'm the guy who had to load the bus as a freshman. As a senior, I didn't have to load the bus. But what was I doing? I was driving the bus because the younger players weren't as experienced a driver. So you kind of share some of those duties. You know, if I was the guy who had to pick up the balls after BP because I was a freshman, so be it. If I was the guy who had to be the soft toss guy all the time, so be it. But as you progress, sometimes your responsibilities change, your experiences change. And some of that I still think needs to be in as part of the game. And a little bit of it has to do with some of the respect that I think players who have more experience should garner. Now, obviously, there are things that go well beyond the lines of that. And we know what those things are. I think everybody has a pretty good sense of what those things are, whether it's what Akeem Alou experienced, whether it's what Daniel Carcillo experienced. So there's no doubt that there is kind of that two-sided thing, but we can't completely eradicate some of these things that are good for structure. And why, Scott? Why? Because we're preparing people for life. If you go on to your show and you haven't done your due diligence on your show and you walk out and the program director says, hey, you know what? Great job today. Way to go. That's not what he should be doing. He should be telling, hey, buddy, you had a guest on. You didn't even know who he was, who she was, what they were talking about. How come you're not prepared? You should be called to the mat for that. Sometimes we're going to face adversity in life. And you know what? I think sports is a great vehicle to be able to teach some of those life lessons, and we forget that sometimes.
Yeah, at its best, it is one of the best vehicles available to us. Sam Cosentino joining me here, Sportsnet hockey analyst. Let's turn our attention to the World Junior Selection Camp. What's your initial impression of what you see available for selection and perhaps what the identity of this team this year is going to look like?
Yeah, really fascinating to me. It's a young group. It's a short camp. It's a small camp. So 31 players. Typically, we're seeing 32, 33, 36 players. When I look at the youth, first-year draft eligibles, seven of them, including Alexi Lafreniere, who's a returning player. A couple of those guys are late birthdays, which I understand, who essentially have had almost a full extra year of playing hockey. But the youth, my goodness. And then, Scott, you think that this is traditionally a 19-year-old tournament, and it has been. But with the way the National Hockey League has gotten younger, this tournament has gotten younger. You think about all the players that are yearly eligible to play for this event that are too busy playing in the National Hockey League. The same thing is going to ring true this year. And I think for Canada, with how few returnees there are and some of the pro guys still up in the air, it's going to be a really interesting group. But when I look at this group and what the identity will be, it's going to have to be a hardworking, skilled team. Oh, yeah, no guff, Sammy. But what I mean by that is I don't think you're going to see the traditional, hey, share the ice time, you know, the power play. We better get both units out there. We have to kind of, you know, ease the way we politically manage this group. I don't think you're going to see any of that. I think Dale and Mark Hunter have selected this group along with Brad McEwen for a specific reason. They have some ideas of how they've identified their people and what they want them to do. And you may very well go out and see guys, a five-man unit that plays all 2 minutes on a power play. And you may see the same three or four people out there every penalty kill. I think this is a coaching staff that's going to identify who's best in what roles and really utilize them to the max in those particular roles.
I do want to get into some of the drivers of this team that are on the selection camp roster, but you mentioned the pro guys, Barrett Hayton, Kirby Dach, Joe Valeno, Noah Dobson. Do you expect any of those players to play for our National World Junior team?
Well, I'd say Valeno probably has the best chance. Now, he's played a little bit better lately with Grand Rapids in the Detroit Red Wings organization. But you have Steve Yzerman, a guy who's been very familiar with Hockey Canada's program, and a guy who I think sees tremendous value in a guy like Valeno returning. Noah Dobson, that's a really interesting one to me. He's been utilized very little at the National Hockey League level. Maybe it's a situation where Lou Lamoriello says, you know what, if I loan him out to the program now, I can buy myself essentially a month and 2 weeks on the back end of the conditioning stint, yet still be able to get Noah into games in the second half. I think that's questionable. Barrett Hayton's an interesting story. I'm not so sure that he'll be made available, but again, he hasn't played a ton, and Kirby Dach would be the least likely of any of them based on how he's produced so far for the Chicago Blackhawks.
Who do you expect to be the drivers of this year's team? They're all good players. They all play prominent roles on their junior clubs or NCAA clubs, but who are the drivers that are going to be handed the keys by Dale Hunter?
Yeah, I think Bowen Byram in the back end, I think he's the guy that, you know, you got to let him run free a little bit. He'll give you some young mistakes at time, but the fourth overall pick, the Colorado prospect, is a guy who can really drive the play from the back end. I think Ty Smith is another one of those guys. Kalen Addison, you're talking about guys in the back end who they're at their best when they're able to get up and go, not when they're harnessed, not when they're held back. They oftentimes, I think you're going to see, you know, four-man rushes and that sort of thing done responsibly. I think you're going to see these guys being able to transition, you know, killing plays and neutralizing, transitioning with a four-man group going up ice the other way. So I think you're going to see some of that. And that, to me, starts with some of the guys, you know, what we're seeing on the back end. You know, you look at the goaltending situation, that's in and of itself a very interesting prospect here moving forward. But when you look at some of the guys up front, I don't know, I'm looking at, like, you know, Quentin Byfield is a guy who I think has a real good chance to do something. I think Dawson Mercer, as some of those draft eligible guys that we talk about, have a real good chance of driving the play. But ultimately, you're probably going to find that it's going to be your 19-year-old guys who I think are going to end up driving the play up front for Canada.
Sportsnet hockey analyst Sam Cosentino in conversation with us here this morning on the Scott Rintoul Show. There's always that player or a couple of players who vault their way up the rankings in advance of the draft because of their performance at the World Juniors. quite often those are players from overseas because they simply haven't been seen by North American eyes as often as the guys we're talking about with Team Canada. Are there any guys at the top of your list as you could see as major risers at this tournament?
In terms of the draft eligible players?
Correct.
Yeah. Well, I mean, when I look across the country, or right across the, you know, the entirety of the tournament, you have to think about the Swedish twins, Lucas Raymond and Alexander Holtz. Those would be two guys there that I think are going to have a real positive impact for Sweden. And when I look at Jan Mišák as a Czech player, when I look at Canada's guys, I think, you know, the guys that we mentioned, I think Cole Perfetti's the guy who's a genius when it comes to, you know, the shootouts, which is an important piece. Quentin Byfield, I think, is big and strong enough to be able to handle it. Alexis Lafreniere, a draft-eligible guy who I think his experience was just okay last year. I think he's going to use this year as a big proven ground, and I think we're going to be able to get to see the real impact he's going to be able to have on the game as first-year draft-eligible guys. So, yeah, I do think there are going to be some of those guys that will have an impact despite being what would essentially be known as double underage players.
Alexis Lafreniere is still at the top of the list as far as draft eligibles go. I know you're in the midst of publishing your latest rankings. What's the most significant thing in your eyes that's changed over the course of the past month?
Well, I kind of look more towards the back end, and I think the back end of it's really opened up. I think we're pretty safely able to identify 15 or 20 guys that we see comfortably being shifted throughout that top 20. But I think after that, things really start to change. A guy like Ty Smolenak, of the U.S. program, is a, you know, hardworking, energy type of guy. Connor Zeri in Kamloops has had an unbelievable start to the season. He continues to produce. You know, Maverick Bork out in Shawinigan's doing such a great job with the Cats, going up against top guys as a 17-year-old. So that's where I think there's hay to be made here. When I look at what I project to be the picks between 18 and 40, I think there's a lot of room for improvement. And I think even on my list from this month, going back to November's list, there's been some changes already, and I would expect more to come as a result of what's going to happen at the World Juniors.
And I know we'll dig more into detail of this once the calendar flips over and we start looking to Montreal in that draft and the NHL sorts itself out and certain teams know whether or not they'll be near the top of the board. But just as a draft class en masse, the entirety of it here, Sam, the whispers in Vancouver here last summer was, man, you wait until you see the 2020 draft. It's going to be the best one since 2015. Do you still feel the same way?
Yeah, I really like it. I really love our high end. I love the top 15 guys. And I'm thinking about, you know, Yaroslav Askarov, the right catching goalie, who's just been a dynamo with the Russians. Like, is this a guy going to be a guy who gets inside the top 10? Is he going to get as high as the top five, the highest guy since Carey Price was picked? That's a real possibility here in this draft. And that, when you see a goalie go that high, it tends to shake things up a little bit. But Stutzel has emerged out of Germany. Lafreniere is where he is. Byfield's probably going to challenge him for number one. So I love the high end. In terms of the entirety, as we get down through seven, there's always going to be, Scott, those guys that emerge as third rounders that you're like, oh, wow, how come this guy wasn't taken in the first round? But I do like the depth of this draft. I really do. And I'm starting to like it more and more now that I'm looking at guys that what I project to be from that 18 to 40 range. That range of players has increased significantly for me over the last month.
Very quickly, you mentioned the goaltender. We saw one drafted in the first round last year, and Spencer Knight went 13th overall to Florida. There were a few years it was taboo to take a goaltender in the first round. Why has that clawed back a little for some organizations?
It beats me because I sure as hell would never do it. they just take too long. They're an interesting breed, these guys. They take too long, in my opinion, is they really don't get good till they're about 25 years old. Let another team draft them, try and develop them, let them go on to a second team. By the time he gets to his third team, he's 25, 26 as a free agent. Come on over, let's talk then.
20% of the time, it works every time.
Yeah, you got it.
Hey, Sam, great stuff, man. I always appreciate the conversation. Looking forward to your coverage of the World Juniors again this year and look forward to having a conversation with you about this soon, too.
Okay, thanks a lot, Scott. Take care.
Absolutely. Sam Cosentino, wide-ranging interview there. We started with where we're at in the conversation, how it applies to junior hockey, how it applies to minor league hockey across this country, and then we'll start to dig into the details of this World Junior Selection Camp. Hard-working team. We've seen those before. We've seen those be successful before. And a young team this year. We'll see what the decisions are with some of those NHL prospects, guys who are in pro hockey right now, either at the American Hockey League level or playing for teams like Chicago in the case of Kirby Dock or Barrett Hayton in Arizona. Likelihood of those guys coming? Pretty small. Dobson and Valeno are interesting ones. If they're not being used much, I know there's the fear of injury, but it all depends on the philosophy of the organization. There are certain guys around the National Hockey League, and he mentioned Steve Yzerman in Detroit being one of them, that say playing on a stage like that, playing in those pressure-packed environments and feeling good about your game, gaining the confidence of playing a big role on a team like Team Canada, that can springboard you into your pro career in a way that maybe what's been going on this first year or the last couple of years of your development haven't been able to do. I think as Canadians who get invested in this tournament, we will all want to see that happen. But I also understand the fear of injury. I understand all of those things. I do hope we get to see some of those guys play, bolster our chances here at this year's tournament. As mentioned, there's a lot of great messages pouring in, some great comments. We will get to those on the other side as well. And we will compare and contrast a couple of firings. It's been a tough time for coaching in general over the past couple of weeks. Not a great day for a couple of guys in the NFL and NHL. And I will put those firings into perspective for you next on the Scott Rintoul Show.
Welcome to the Scott Rintoul Show.
There he is, Van Riemsdyk in. He scores! James Van Riemsdyk beats Anderson, his sixth of the year. And it's suddenly 6-1, five goals for the Flyers.
And here I thought the Leafs were never going to lose again. Not everything was fixed by the hiring of Sheldon Keefe. Not suggesting it's his fault or that there are fundamental flaws because they gave up five goals in the final 10 minutes last night against the Philadelphia Flyers. But there's still a few things to navigate in Toronto. You got to figure out what they're doing salary structure-wise. They got to figure out that backup goaltending situation. There are things to get through. It's not going to be smooth sailing. 6-1 losers last night were the Toronto Maple Leafs. I know that breaks a lot of hearts around the country. Breaks a lot of hearts, especially in the West. Scott Rintoul with you. Thanks for jumping in on the conversation, and we will continue to have it. Here are some really good texts and emails coming in this morning. You've got the text line. You've got the fan feedback line. Hit us up. You can find me on Twitter at Scott Rintoul. Many of them addressing the ongoing conversation about coaching players, the interaction between the two, what constitutes professional conduct, what goes beyond that, where we are in the gray area, what are we taking from people's pasts that we can have a conversation with today. You know, I did get this one text in saying everything viewed under the lens of 2019 political correctness can be seen as inappropriate. I understand that comment. There are certain things that I think we can all agree on. It's an unsigned text. Sign your text, please, so we can give you credit. I understand the comment, but we can all agree there are things like what Akeem Aliyu alleged and Bill Peters cop to in that statement put out. That's not just political correctness. That's 10 years ago, 20 years ago. Like, everybody knew that's not the type of language you can use. So that's a line that has been crossed. There are certain things that are going to come out that are going to be seen as relatively minor, and there are not going to be great consequences for them. And there are other things that people can go, oh, hold on, sorry, what happened? I'm sorry, he did what? No, you can't do that. I know it was a different time, but you can't do that. That's the conversation we're having right now. And I'm getting some really interesting messages on that. This one comes in that says, I really like this conversation about coaches, and I think we're moving in the right direction. What about some players that have bullied other players? Should they be suspended by the league and by their teams? We're certainly not at that point yet, and I mentioned this yesterday on the show. There is a different standard for players than there is for coaches, than there is for general managers, than there is for owners. The more responsibility you take on, the more responsibility you have to conduct yourself in a certain manner. Players, not that everything they say or do is okay, But there actually is a department in place to hold them accountable to a certain degree. We don't always like the decisions that come down or lack of accountability that we charge the NHL Department of Player Safety with. Ah, come on, how did you not suspend that guy? Why didn't you suspend that guy longer? But there is an office in place, and there's something that is there that is supposed to hold these players accountable. Now, we can change the standards, but realize the standard for players has to be different than it is for coaches, because we are asking these people to play on an edge and do things that you can't do in everyday society. We're asking them to hit. We're asking them to line up a body check that you might know is a 50-50. I don't know if I'm going to hit him in the back. I don't know if I'm going to hit him in the front, but I'm going in for it anyway because I got to finish my check or I need to change the energy in this game, all of these different things. And they get to a point where emotions run wild. Not everything is okay. There are certain lines that still cannot be crossed. And when you do cross them, you got to be held accountable. But some of the things that get said, they get said in the heat of the moment. There's emotion behind them. And the players have been pushed to this level because that's what is demanded of them in their sport. Most of them are somewhat accountable for this. When they are called on the carpet for it, they don't generally deny it. They say, yeah, I said that in the heat of the moment. I shouldn't have said that. I'm going to reach out to this guy and apologize. And there have been incidents in the past. I know it's going back a long time, but if we want to use the Bill Peters parallel, Chris Simon was suspended in 1998 for 3 games. Racial slur against Mike Greer. That's a long time ago, but there is a precedent for it happening. It's all part of the conversation. Mike says, some people who are asking why now, you should remind people that trauma doesn't have an expiration date. That's a very good point. And we can't just be judge and jury right away, 15 seconds in. Oh, I heard the accusation. Nah, it's not a big deal, or it is. You got to hear more of the story. Got to hear more of a story. This one I disagree with. It's from Tyler. Again, whether I disagree or agree, I like the fact that you're sending these in because this is what this conversation is about as we try to work our way through it. Nobody has all of the answers. Tyler says this, how about we judge people for what they do today, not 10 years ago? Yes, people made mistakes, but who you are 10 years ago might not be who you are today. And if you are, then you're out. It's true people evolve. That said, that doesn't completely erase their past. If there is something that is a major transgression that happened 10 years ago, yeah, you should be held accountable for it. And there is a confluence of standards that has to be applied. Well, here's the era we were dealing with when it happened. Here's the way we view it now. What are the ramifications? But it's too easy to say, well, it was 10 years ago, things have changed, but just wipe the slate clean. I can give you a lot of different examples. I can give you some pretty sordid examples that I'm sure you would agree with that go down the topic of abuse. If we want to take it to an extreme. But I would use it as something as simple as this that all of you could relate to in your everyday lives. Whether you've been through anything like that or know anybody who's been through that or not. You all work. If you found out today that 10 years ago, your employer had been stealing money from you and had taken thousands of dollars from you, would you try to make that right? Or would you say, well, it was 10 years ago. Let's just sweep it under the rug. No, you would go after that money. Oh, this guy stole $70,000 from me that I was owed. Probably going to go try to make that right. So we can't just sweep everything away. Somebody stole $5 from you 10 years ago. You're probably not going to claim that money. You're probably not tracking that person down saying, hey, the $5 that you took, you never paid me back. Compounding the interest, no, you're probably not chasing down the $5. $70,000, $100,000, you're probably going to go down that road. Keep them coming in. This is great. What would be the punishment if an owner was found out to be bullying? It would be more severe. It would have to be more severe. And again, bullying is a very broad term. It would really depend what the allegations were. But yeah, owners would be held more accountable. We have seen owners being forced to sell their teams in certain situations. Look what happened with Donald Sterling in the NBA. That might be at the height of it with some of the untenable behavior that Donald Sterling had, the NBA forced him to sell his team. And you can be cynical and say, yeah, the guy made a couple billion dollars. Sure, but he didn't want to relinquish power of that team. The league stepped in and said, you're not here anymore. You've gone beyond the line. You've done it repeatedly. You're out. Beat it. The higher you go up the food chain, the more accountable you have to be. Scott Rentoul with you. Keep those texts coming in. This is great stuff. There were two coaches that were let go yesterday. One in hockey, one in football. John Hines was let go in New Jersey. The Devils, they are bad. They are a lot worse than they thought. And we heard for the first couple of months of the season, you know what? John Hines is a really good coach. They're probably not going to do anything right now, but it got far worse than they ever expected. So John Hines got let go in New Jersey. Ron Rivera, more surprising in the NFL. More surprising because this is a guy who took a team to a Super Bowl. It's been a while, and since ownership has changed hands in Carolina, Ron Rivera hasn't been great, but the Panthers haven't been great. They have been, well, they've been Cam Newton most of that time. So are you getting rid of Ron Rivera because he can't coach? Are you getting rid of Ron Rivera because you don't have Cam Newton? This is an owner who said he would not accept mediocrity. We'll hear from him in what they're saying, by the way. But just so you know, look at the two leagues and just look at the difference in tenure for coaches. The longest serving coach right now in the NHL is anyone? John Cooper. That's who's been on the job the longest. He was hired March 25th, 2013. That's not a long time. That means there are seven NFL coaches who've held jobs longer. There are three NBA coaches who've held jobs longer, although there are a bunch that were hired that same year as John Cooper, and they've been in their positions for a decent amount of time, almost the exact same amount of time. And there's two Major League Baseball managers who've had gigs longer. Baseball and hockey, that is the fire the coach, fire the manager sport. Happens all the time. The turnover is nuts. The NFL is interesting. The NFL is an interesting dichotomy. There are half of the coaches right now in the NFL who have had their jobs for less than two seasons. They were either hired in 2018 or they were hired this past year. And that's as long as they've been on the job. And then there's a quarter of the league. So half of the league's only been there since 2018. A quarter of the league's been there since 2014 or earlier. And in some cases, there are six guys right now in the NFL. They have had their posts since 2010 or earlier. And every single one of them, save one, has won a Super Bowl. The only guy on the list who's been employed since 2010 or earlier with his current team is Jason Garrett. So that's why the heat's creeping up. That's why if they don't win a Super Bowl in Dallas this year, he's likely gone. Because everybody else on the list, Bill Belichick, kind of in a class of his own. Been to nine Super Bowls. He's won six of them. He's had his gig since 2000. That seems to be working out okay. Sean Payton. It's been a long time since the Saints won a Super Bowl. He's been there since 2006. They got theirs in 2008. But he's been there 14 years. This is his 14th season. Mike Tomlin has a Super Bowl. He's been to a couple. John Harbaugh in Baltimore. They made that hire in 2008. He's got himself a Super Bowl. Pete Carroll. He's the other guy on the list, and he's been to two. And he's got himself a Super Bowl. The NHL, nobody keeps their job for very long. The NFL, you've at least got a chance. NBA, not so much unless you're Greg Popovich, but there's more staying power in the NBA than other sports. NBA's second on the list. But hockey and baseball, man, you don't like the way things are going? All right, let's get the next guy in. It's not always the guy can't coach. Barry Trotz, really good coach, held on for a really long time in Nashville. Really long time. There's certain organizations that are more patient, and there are certain markets that will bear it. Being in Canada, tough gig. Tough to hold on to your job for a really long time in this country. You got any comments on that? Hit me up. Let's get to what they're saying.
Bro, what are you talking about, man?
What are you saying?
Not saying anything.
You're saying something?
I guess that's what I'm saying, Brooksy.
Here's what they're saying.
as mentioned, really busy night around the National Hockey League last night. A lot of the comments you've heard on this show this morning from the hockey world have been about the ongoing conversation, about where we're at with coaching and players and conduct. That's where a lot of the audio came from yesterday. But as far as those who actually stepped on the ice, those who were involved in other sports stories, this is an opportunity for us to get those in. I do want to mention Carl English is going to join us at the bottom of the hour. He's got a really compelling book coming out. It's out right now. It's available online. They're trying to get it in more stores across the country. Carl English, former Canadian basketball player, he will be on with me at the bottom of this hour. Really interested to get into that story. How about Patrick Laine? Hasn't had the goals this year, but the points are there. And he hasn't gone through those massive slumps that we saw last season. He's only got, what, 9 goals now in the season after scoring last night. But if he played the Dallas Stars every game, he would have a lot more of those. Have a listen to him after the Jets beat the Stars 5-1 last night, and they asked him about how good he's been, how productive he's been against that particular team.
No, I wish we would play 82 against those guys. We'd have a lot of goals. You know, it just seems like it just goes in. Just don't have any explanation. But, well, thank God they're in our division, so I'm laughing.
I love it when guys say stuff like that. Usually they say, sometimes you just get lucky, or my line has played really well those games. I don't have any reason to explain it. No, man, I wish we played them every single game. I'm really good against these guys. Here's how good Laine has been against the Stars. 16 career games, 18 goals. He had one disallowed last night, or that would be up to 19. 18 goals, 24 points for Patrick Laine in 16 games against Dallas. I did mention there's some other great stories right now flying under the radar. I'm not sure Laine qualifies to the level of these other ones. Just before we get to a little more audio, let me give you a couple of these NHL stories. If I were to ask you, give me the top three guys as far as even strength goals go this year, you'd get the first two. You would. Leon Draisaitl, Brad Marchand. You'd probably guess Pasternak. He's not there. He's done a lot of it on the power play. But Draisaitl, Marchand, those are guys that would come to mind. Do you want to know who is second with 14 even strength goals this year? Jakub Vrana. Maybe call him Jacob if you North Americanize his name. Vrana has 14 even strength goals this year. Every single goal he scored has been even strength. He's been great for the Capitals. Speaking of the Capitals, this stat came out last night, and it really puts into perspective the start John Carlson has had. John Carlson has 40 points after scoring and getting a couple of assists last night. He's done that before the 30-game mark. This is getting lost a little bit right now because Carlson was leading the league in scoring, but since Draisaitl and McDavid have taken off, we've kind of cooled our jets on Carlson. We just haven't paid attention as much to that story. John Carlson is the third defenseman in the history of the National Hockey League to do that, have 40 points before 30 games. The other guys who have done it, Bobby Orr did it 5 times. He was good. You don't need stats to tell you that. Al MacInnis is the only other guy who's done it. He did it one time, 90-91. That's the kind of air we're talking about, the rare air we're talking about with John Carlson. Connor Hellebuck, while we're on the Jets, he has a .934 save percentage. He's tied for the most wins in the NHL with 14. And he's faced the fourth most shots. And the stat that jumps out with Hellebuck, who is having one of those years where he's going to get himself a Vezina nomination if this continues, he has allowed 1 goal or less in 9 games already this season. That's remarkable. That's the most in the NHL in that category. And now I'm going to throw this last one in because it seems to boggle my mind. As good as this guy has been over his career, it's not been a great year for Pekka Rinne. He has a save percentage that is under .900 right now. It's .899. But he leads the league in shutouts. Because why not? He's got 3 of them so far this year. Moving on with what they're saying, they would like to have a guy leading the league in shutouts in Toronto. It's not going that way right now. I can't put it all on Freddie Anderson. I know it's a 6 spot they gave up last night, but that was on the Leafs more than their starting goaltender. Austin Matthews came out, and he ripped his team a little bit.
You know, we tie it up, give up a goal. We feel like we're still kind of in it. You got a chance to pull the goal. We still got a couple minutes left. But we let that empty net goal, and then, I mean, we can't just fold like that. It's unacceptable to do that to our starting goalie, a guy that's stolen games for us. He's been a brick wall for us all year, and that's just unacceptable on our part. We can't just fold. We got to play the last that last minute because, that's just unacceptable. We just left him out to dry. breakaway, two-on-ones. I mean, odd man rushes there in the last minute, you know, suddenly the score's 6-1. So, I mean, that's on us. That just can't happen.
That's relatively strong. Unacceptable. Fold. Can't happen. It's pretty strong stuff from Austin Matthews going after his team a little bit yesterday. I do wonder if players are going to feel more comfortable speaking their mind in Toronto after this coaching change. Some of it has to do with maturity. The Leafs have always been really guarded. Remember the first year those guys broke in? They weren't allowed to talk to the media. They weren't allowed to talk to the media after games. Austin Matthews, Mitch Marner, no, those guys aren't talking. What do you mean? They're going to be the centerpiece of your team moving. No, those guys, no. Lou Lamoriello, rookies don't talk. What? In today's day and age? With what broadcasting rights cost? With the access you have? Those guys aren't going to talk? I do wonder now that it's a new regime and that Kyle Dubas really has full control of that organization if we're going to see better access, a little more exposure for some of the young, high-profile players in Toronto. Switching over to the NFL, I told you that in Carolina, they fired their coach yesterday. The season's basically done. This is a team that was 5-2. At one point, the Carolina Panthers, they're now 5-7. They've lost five straight. Hasn't gone well for Ron Rivera, and it won't go any longer for Ron Rivera. David Tepper is the guy who bought the team. He's the guy who's overseen the last 29 games of Ron Rivera's coaching career in Carolina. And here's what he had to say about his decision.
When you say someone's not going to have 5 years to get things turned around, do you think I can promise to anybody that things are going to be great in 1 year?
No.
Do you believe in the tooth fairy? Santa Claus? Which guy do you like?
No, but you can.
If you don't think I have to build something long term, wait, if you don't think it takes time to build something great, if you think something great gets built in 1 second, then that's wrong. You shouldn't expect it. Fans shouldn't expect it. Okay? I'm not talking about 1 year. I'm talking of a standard that will be built and sustained. Okay? Built and sustained. That if the fans are expecting something to be miraculous next year, listen, it could happen. Maybe, you know, that's that good. But you can't count on that. Okay? There has to be a degree of patience to build sustained excellence.
What does that sound like? That sounds like Cam Newton is looking for work somewhere else next year, doesn't it? Ron Rivera's out. Feels like they're turning the page completely. And if the owner is preaching patience right now, we can't predict this is going to be great next year. Well, the guy who could turn things around in a hurry, at least potentially, is Cam Newton. His stats since his MVP season, they're not great. And he has been banged up. And you wonder how much of a toll the wear and tear has taken on his body for what's left of his career as it is. But Cam Newton, the most important position in football and a guy you've built this franchise around for the better part of the last decade, that's the guy that could potentially come in and turn things around in a hurry if you were still willing to invest in him. That comment to me does not speak to that. I know he wasn't talking about Newton specifically, but when you were turning the page on the coach, that suggests you were turning the page on the quarterback as well and that Cam Newton is going somewhere else. You've got a star in Christian McCaffrey in that backfield. You have some nice receivers. Curtis Samuel's had a very nice year. DJ Moore has come into prominence in the last couple of years. It's a defense that has worn down over the season, but one that has had some pretty nice moments and has some pretty decent pieces. But now the owner is preaching patience. Does that mean he goes with a young head coach? Very interesting times in Carolina as they really switch gears. That division has been a disappointment overall. New Orleans is at the top of it. New Orleans is the only team that's clinched a playoff berth so far because everybody else has sucked. Second best team in that division is 5-7. NFC East is probably worse. That's a worse division overall because they don't have a Saints. That NFC South has been terrible this year for the most part. We're going to turn our attention to basketball next. It's an incredible story just on basketball alone, but the background of Carl English, you need to hear it. You'll want to tune into this next. Why was it so difficult to write a book about chasing the NBA dream? Find out on the Scott Rentola Show.
Now more of the Scott Rentola Show.
If you've been a college hoops fan for quite some time and you had a rooting interest in Canadians in the NCAA, like I always did, and really was that ever brought into prominence with a guy like Steve Nash in the early 90s, then you may know the name Carl English. I certainly do. I can remember following him at the University of Hawaii and always hoping he was going to make the NBA. Well, that's what he always hoped as well. He never quite got there, and now he has written a book about it, but there's a lot more there than you would be led to believe simply by me outlining that. Scott Rintoul with you. Thanks for listening to the Scott Rintoul Show. Longtime Canadian hoopster, Carl English. As mentioned, the book is Chasing the Dream, and he joins me now to discuss that and a whole lot more regarding Canada basketball. Carl, thank you very much for doing this morning. How are you?
I'm great, buddy. Thanks for having me on.
No problem whatsoever. And I think those who may not know your backstory, they see a guy who they kind of knew from basketball circles, and they see a book come out called Chasing the Dream, trying to get to the NBA. They think they know the story, but I don't think they really know it's at the heart of it. I saw you recently say it was very difficult for you to write this book. What made it so difficult?
Well, first off, it was a nightmare because anytime you're faced with your demons from the past, you're reliving them. So I was first approached to write the book, to do a book or any type of thing like that was my freshman year in Hawaii. Once we went to the tournament and, you know, CBS did a big story. They came down actually to Newfoundland, and once they saw where I was from and a small town of 30, 40 people, and then found out about my background, tragedy at five and so forth, their producers contacted me about doing a book. And I just, you know, I was insecure or whatnot at the time and, you know, turned it down. I've turned it down for many years, and then I decided to do it. And I think a big part of turning it down is I knew I'd have to face it. When I always call myself a seasoned vet when it comes to the media. Once you do so many interviews over the years, you'll never get what you want from an athlete like that, and they'll never tell you what they want to hear because they're always politically correct. But when I did the book with Blake, it was a tell-all. I really told how it made me feel. I told how it affected, you know, losing your parents at the age of five was devastating, and then I'm separated from all my brothers, and you know that affects you. But at five, you really don't know what's going on. But at 10 and 15, it really takes a toll on you. And I got into detail on that. I got into detail on, you know, my journey to get to just even get to Hawaii. I left Newfoundland to get recruited when I was in grade to go to grade 12, and all the teachers went on strike, so I'm up in Ontario and couldn't play basketball. And one of the ways I got recruited was I took all the I went to the guidance counselor. He got me the book of the American schools. I took a video of myself in the gym, and I put on a high school game from Newfoundland, and I dubbed that in the video room, went out and bought 150 DVD or not DVDs. They would have been a lot easier. I got VHSs at the time, and I went and sent them out to all the schools, and then that's how they got back to me, and then they tried to come watch me, but they couldn't watch me play. And then I went to some different tournaments on AU basketball. It was just starting up. And that's how I got recruited on that circus. But then it takes it on through. I lost my father, my second father, Uncle Junior, when I came back from Hawaii. He dropped dead when we came in from fishing, and how that affected me. But then it was all the passion and the disappointment with not making the NBA, the amount of money that was lost on that, just on endorsements and contracts, and then on through to European and dealing with injuries. So it's an in-depth look, and we've been getting fabulous reviews. I just left the publisher, and I think what's a bestseller, like 5,000 copies?
I think that's right.
Someone told me. Yeah, okay. So we've done over 5,000 in 4 days, so things are going well.
They certainly are from a book-selling perspective. It's Chasing the Dream, Carl English, written by Blake Murphy. Carl joins me here on the Scott Rintoul Show. The journey from Newfoundland to Hawaii would make for a great story in itself, but as you said, the backdrop of this is a family tragedy. You lost your parents when you were five. You were separated from your brothers and sisters, and because of that, you poured yourself into basketball. Was that simply your escape at the time?
100%. People ask me, was the book therapeutical? And I'll say, no, maybe in a few years it might be. It's amazing to see the story and read it and get it out there. Basketball for me was my sanctuary. It was my scapegoat. It was my freedom in the sense of I just always felt Like, even now when I warm up, I never have the music on. I never block anything out because I want to hear the sounds of the ball bouncing. I want to feel it in my hands. I want to hear the ball going through the net. I just want to focus on the things that really let me fall in love with the game. And for me, it was on the side of the road. If it was windy, I was dribbling and dunking. If it was nice days, I was just shooting, shooting, shooting. And I was obsessed with it. And then it just became a passion. But I think I played so much because I felt free and I felt like, okay, I'm away from what I'm dealing with on a day-to-day basis and just the tragedy and the things. And it always felt that way to me. No matter what's going on in my life, when I step between the lines or I get a ball in my hands, I feel at peace.
So you used basketball as an escape, and obviously you fell in love with the game. You have a deep passion for the game, but here you are 38 years old. All of these feelings are coming up. You're reliving the tragedies in your life, and you realize that basketball is the way you depress those and didn't deal with them in your earlier years. What's your relationship with basketball right now?
Well, I'm trying to figure it out, to be honest. I have some contractual obligations for the team I was with last season that need to be upheld. And until those are met, I'm not going to continue to play. So right now it's just the pickups and the training, which I enjoy. And I love the training part of it and the practice part of it. So I get my energy escapes for there, but there's also, I do camps and schools with kids, and my son is starting to get pretty active with it there now. So all those things, as long as I'm around the game, and then obviously everything I'm doing with the book right now is helping a lot as well. It's one of those things I've come to peace with. I feel these tragedies. They used to define me, but I think they define me now as a man and who I've become and my values and how I am as a father. So all these things would shape you. I never let it break me, and it's obviously made me into the person I am today.
How does it impact you as a father, knowing that you have a relationship with your children right now that you were not able to enjoy to its fullest extent with your own parents?
I tell you what, you appreciate it a lot more. And it's hard for me. It's really hard at this age right now, which is strange. Is like my daughter's 5 and her room is next to mine, and she'll cry out to my mother or her mother or myself at times. And I'm thinking in my head, that's the age I was. And then my oldest two kids, 11 and 10, well, that was the age of my brother. So I'm thinking, like, what in the hell did we do? You know what I mean? And I see it that. So I cherish every moment. I don't take things for granted anymore. And I never did. Once you live those type of things, you really value everything about it. And even when you're dealing with difficult things in your life, man, it really puts things into perspective. And I try to be the best father that I can.
Carl English has written a book. It's called Chasing the Dream. It's how he dealt with the tragedy in his life and used basketball to help him through that. He joins me here on the Scott Rintoul Show. Newfoundland's a long way from the University of Hawaii, and you detailed a little earlier in the interview how you went to Ontario. You had to put VHS tapes together. For those who haven't seen where you grew up playing basketball, it literally is a hoop on the side of the road. It's kind of Jimmy Chitwood in Hoosiers. That's what you remember. How much of your decision to go to the University of Hawaii was to get as far away from as possible from that?
The crazy thing was, and it's funny about Hawaii, so I was supposed to go to a prep school. Syracuse had no scholarships left. And I was supposed to go to a prep school in Pennsylvania, and all this is in the book, Chasing a Dream. But I was supposed to go to that prep school, and when Hawaii came on board, it was late in the summer. So I went to what's called Atlantic Cape Camp. So I didn't have enough recognition to go to the ABC Adidas camps or the Nike Elite camp. So I was dominating this Atlantic Cape camps, and in the MVP game, I was MVP of the camp. The scouts came over. So after that, I had 20, 30 offers. And I said, well, each player gets to take, I think it was 4 or 5 visits. So I just told my family, I was like, man, I'm going to Hawaii. I was like, I'll never have a chance to go to a place like this. I said, I'm just going there. I'm going to take the visit, you know, get on the beach for a little bit and enjoy it. But sure enough, when I got out there, Riley was great. The coaches were great. Scott Rougeau was the main coach that recruited me. He was great. And then the people. And it had so many similarities to Newfoundland in the sense of the rugged coastline and the people, the way they were as friendly. The only thing I'd have to tell you, and you'd understand this, is the Newfoundland weather is way better than Hawaii, so it really affected my decision. But other than that, it was a great place to go to school. But now, not knowing and knowing what I know now, to get recruited is very difficult, or get scouted to the NBA, because NBA scouts are not really going out to Hawaii. They will see you when you come on the road, but most people have the best games at home. So that was the thing I had to deal with later on.
And I can remember, as all of us did in this country who loved basketball, watching you in the tournament that you referenced earlier, and University of Hawaii was there, and you were a guy who could fill it up and you could shoot from long range. That's the type of game that now the NBA is built on, long-range shooting. It's either a three or it's a dunk. Do you ever feel, Carl, like your game came along just a little too early, that you were just in the wrong era?
100%. When you look at it and you see, I mean, imagine now that fast-paced up and down and shooting threes. I mean, I led the ACB, which is the best league outside the NBA, in scoring almost 20 a game, but I shot 48 or 46%. So imagine getting up and down and in the NBA with the way the game is. I always say two things. I mean, with the social media era and the internet, which I never had when I was coming up through, I probably never would have had to leave Newfoundland to get recruited. And the second one is the way the game has changed over the years. I think I was probably 20 years too early. So, you know, it's the way it goes. I mean, I've had a fabulous career, I feel, you know, from a Canadian standpoint, and even an American one from an overseas. Obviously, my dream was to make the NBA, and it came up short. But, you know, it's been a hell of a journey, I must say.
And you've played for Canada basketball. You've made lots of money playing over in Europe throughout the course of your career, and you've had a starring role on many of those teams. Do you have any regrets about your career?
The biggest regret, and that's probably in the book as well, the biggest regret that I have is when I became, we call it a rock star, when I became the main guy in Europe, so it's kind of like the NBA. In the NBA, when the signing deadline comes or comes out, they're going after the big guys. They're going after your main stars, and everybody gets launched up. Well, when you're going after a guy like me, I would probably sign in September or October, right? So it's the same thing in Europe. In Europe, as soon as June hit, the main teams would want me, and that's when you get the biggest money. So I'd always sign. What the regret I have is when I got good over there and I was leading these leagues and scoring and dominating, that's when I should have came back and tried the NBA, because that's when I was at my best. And I have a regret that I never left the money and left everything. But it was the sense of security as well, because I was a father then. I had two of my kids in Spain. And for me to go back home and try the NBA, if I got cut in November or December, well, then what happens to my family? We could end up in, you know, a place, a country that's not safe, or a country that, you know, that you're not, you know, don't have English school. There's so many things affected my decisions later on that it came. And there was no such thing that they have now, these two-way contracts and stuff. So, you know, that's probably my biggest regret.
Carl English, longtime Canadian hoopster, has a book out now. It's called Chasing the Dream. He joins me on the Scott Rintoul Show. Canada basketball was a much different place when you were coming up than it is right now. We can fill an entire roster with NBA players. Did you see this tidal wave of talent coming for Canadian basketball?
I mean, it was coming. It was funny because I remember Tristan and Corey came into camp, I want to say when they were 18 or 16, 17 or 18, and you're like, wow, these guys are good. And then Wiggins was around, and then even RJ. RJ was always around because his dad was around, but I remember him when he was like 12, 13 years old. And you see these young guys, and then Kelly came in, and the way Dwight was there, and all these guys were some part coming around. And I played with Jamal in 2015. I'm like, wow, this guy's special. You can have an idea. You know how you have an idea of if they're going to be good or not? When they come in and they go at you with no fear, you know? And they come in and they're not cocky, but they're just hungry, but they're not backing down for nobody. You know, then they have the drive and the confidence. And a lot of these ones that are coming there now that I just mentioned had that special drive. The wave that's there right now is incredible. It is a sensitive subject, and I'm sure you're going to ask, and Kelly's made some quotes and stuff recently, the last couple of days. I'm playing and playing for your country. And it's a very heated debate, and I can give a different insight because I was involved for 15 years and what it really means. So you know, it's up to you if we want to go down that road or not.
Absolutely. How do you view it? Because you were always eager to play. So how do you view it when high-profile players decline the invitation to play for Canada?
Well, let's for the record say that everybody wants to play. Everybody wants to play for Canada unless at an early age they were done wrong by somebody and they're like, oh, shit this. But other than that, everybody wants to play. The thing that comes into effect, and it always came into effect with us, and then it really affected me, is the insurance. Insurance is a big issue when you play for your country because you're putting everything on the line. So you come in and you, it's not about giving up your summers. It's not about giving up your time. It's not about whether you want to play or not want to play. It's the fear of the injury and the insurance to cover your injuries. And then it's also your situation, and everybody has a different one. Like, we take Tristan right now coming in, well, he's going into a free agency. You know, maybe Kelly, I think Kelly's going into the contract as well, or no?
No, he's still got time left on his deal.
Okay, Kelly, but now we look at Kelly firsthand because, you know, I've worked with him and know him personally. And you look at Kelly, well, Kelly's always eager to play, but I bet he second guesses it now because he messed up his knee and he was 3 months behind. So now you go into, right now he's only playing the basketball, right now he's playing the basketball that he should have played at the start of the season. But because of the knee, he was behind, and you sit on the bench. So now you take it if it's – I went on the record as well as saying if you're a franchise, there's a better chance to have a franchise-type player to play because everybody's going to do everything for that guy, right? Everybody's going to protect him. Everybody's going to make sure that he's – that if something goes wrong, that he will get back. But I know the stuff that happened with Paul George scared everybody. But now you take a guy that's – let's say you're a 12th man and you're working to try to get into that rotation. Well, that team might want you there all summer, showing that you're putting in the work, working with the coach every day because that gives them trust in you. Let's say you're a 15th man and you're working for that spot. Well, they want you around, and that's money. And then let's say you're a 7th or 8th man and you're trying to get a starting job. Well, you want to show them you're committed to the organization and you're doing everything possible. Now, let's say you're either one of those guys I just mentioned and you go in there and you get hurt and you miss 6 months. Where do you think you're going to be? If you're the 15th man, you're not on the team. If you're the 12th man fighting for rotation, you're at the end of the bench or probably in the D-League. If you're the 7th or 8th man that was fighting for the starting job, now you're at the end of the bench trying to get into the rotation. This is what people don't understand. We're all selfish in the sense that we want them to play. I want them to play. I truly believe that if they all played, and this is the passion in me coming out, I truly believe if they all played, we'd be a medal and a contender. And I'm not talking about, I'm saying to win it all. That's how good of the talent pool that we have right now. Depending on who the Americans send, they're up in the top three, top two in the world, right? And I've gone on the record, and I think if you're following it, you will agree with me. Is that true fact, right?
I agree.
Yeah. So, but now it's the other aspect of that. When I played in 2012, and it's in my book, I got hurt. I got hurt with Team Canada, and I tore my tricep. I there was insurance in place, but that insurance didn't cover me. I'm still fighting it to this day for that money. But not only that, I was insured for a nice bit of money, but I had $1 million-plus contract on the table that I lost. So I know firsthand what that means. And those guys call me, and if the insurance is in place and it protects them, and even then when it's insurance, like it never protected me. So it's a gamble for these guys. It's a huge gamble, and we all can be selfish. Say, oh, everybody kills Andrew. Everybody kills the guys that don't play. There's so many more things that affects it. You know, what if your GM don't want you to play, right? But he don't publicly want to come out and say it. Well, guess what? He's your employer. You're not going to go against them, right? Like, yeah, you might go against your agent, but you're not going to go against the team. What if your coach don't want you to play? No, I want you here. We're going to develop all these things because I see you as a huge player that's going to make a run for us in the playoffs. Now, the other part is it's in the end of June. What happens if Jamal or one of these guys make a deep run and they go right up till the middle or first week of June? You tell me Denver's going to want him to turn around and go straight after playing 100 games to go straight to play? Hey, you guys gotta understand the game a little bit if you guys think that. So that's my insight on it. I can talk for this for weeks because I know the good and I know the bad. And I've always played. I've always sacrificed for my country, and it's a greatest pleasure for me to put the jersey on. But then I also know what it means like to get hurt and then the effects of that and then the effects of Canada basketball not having my back. So these are the other things that people don't understand, you know, and I know it's a business and I get all the other stuff that comes with it, but it's a tough place to expect these kids to come out and play and risk millions of dollars if the things ain't in place to protect them. And then even if it's fighting, like if you're not in the right place, the NBA is very fickle. Like I said, if you're one of those guys that's fighting for those key roles, well, then you got to be there with the team and they got to see you. Coaches love that. And it's also the relationship that you build with the coach. If you work out with your coach for 4 months, well, guess what? He's going to trust you a lot more than the guy that he never worked out with at all. So these are things to take into consideration when guys don't play. And it's hard for us and all of Canada and all the media because everybody wants them to play because we're so proud of where we are and we're so proud of what we could be. And we're all disappointed when they don't come out because it's frustrating. And I get that. And I'm the same way. But I'm also passionate for these guys as well.
And I can hear that passion. I know that passion will be present in the book as well. Carl, thank you very much for your insight. Excellent perspective. I encourage all of our listeners to go check out your book. It's called Chasing the Dream. Thank you very much for your time this morning.
Thanks, buddy. It'll be, we're trying to get it right across the country. Right now, I know you can get it online. It's on, it's number one seller on Amazon right now on some of those editions. It's, you can get it on Indigo, but I'm trying to get it right across the country.
Well, hopefully we can help with that. Carl English joining us here this morning on the Scott Rintoul Show. It's a compelling story for so many different reasons. It started steeped in tragedy. That drove him to basketball. That drove him to a place of escape. I think that's a lot of the backstory for a lot of people. Not everybody, but I think they use sports as an insulator, use sports to get away from everyday life. A lot of you, me included, we use watching sports for that, to get away from reality a little bit, to watch people throwing a ball around a field or in a hoop or shooting a puck into the net and not think about daily life. And that's why he was driven to basketball. He's been forced to relive it as he goes through this book, and that would be difficult. Losing your parents at five, being split up from your siblings, then losing the uncle that ended up being your caretaker after that. It's a difficult story, and I love the passion he brings at the end. And this is a debate we always have about playing for your country. But what he brought up business-wise is also what's at the heart of the NHL not going to the Olympics. I want to see it. You want to see it. We all want to see it. But I understand why the owners and Gary Bettman are saying, hold on a second here. Until we get a cut of the pie and until the insurance costs are going to be met, I'm sorry, what are we gaining here? I understand the business argument as well. We all want the passionate argument to win out, but I completely understand the business argument. Great stuff with Carl English there. Some excellent feedback from you over the course of the last couple of hours. In Calgary, we're going to send you to Hockey Central. Here in Vancouver, we're going to check in on a couple of other hockey teams that have some interesting situations percolating right now around the National Hockey League, including in Chicago. That's next on the Scott Rintoul Show.
This is the Scott Rintoul Show.
Besser shoots and scores right off the draw. First career NHL goal, Quinn Hughes.
On the official home of the Canucks.
And it's Markstrom again, this time with the glove.
Elias comes and aids, shoots, scores!
Sportsnet 650.
And Antoine Roussel's onto the ice and after it on the forecheck. Fans recognize that and give him a round of applause as he lays a hit in front of the Ottawa bench on Colin White. And Gaudette forces a turnover at center. He's got a chance down the left wing. Gaudette in front of Roussel to the backhand. He scores! Célébu! Antoine Roussel has his first of the year on his first shift of the season. And the Canucks lead 1-0.
We'll work on the French, Batch. We'll work on the French. It was fun there last night. I was in the crowd last night, went to the game with my wife, and that goal certainly hit all the right notes at the right time for the Vancouver Canucks. Scott Rintoul with you. Thanks for joining us here this morning. Antoine Roussel, first shift back, a guy who counted Alex Burrows as his mentor, a guy that came on this program one day ago, just under 24 hours ago. I was sitting with Antoine Roussel at Rogers Arena. He was beaming from ear to ear about getting back in the lineup. He made mention of the fact that he had this one circled on his calendar. Yeah, he wanted to be back in November, but he really wanted to be back for this game. Alex Burrows has a story similar to his. Antoine Roussel certainly hasn't reached the offensive heights that Alex Burrows reached in his career, but undrafted. And that was a theme last night for the Vancouver Canucks. On a night where they celebrated an undrafted player who rose from really the dregs of professional hockey, at least that's what it was considered at the time. Nobody makes the ECHL jump to the AHL and then the NHL. Nobody does that. At least that's the way it was regarded. Alex Burrows did it. He inspired a guy like Antoine Roussel, who was also undrafted, and he comes back on that night and scores on his first shift back. Great description by Batch on that goal. The place was electric last night. There was so much appreciation for Alex Burrows in that crowd. He hit all the right notes with his speech. I thought the team did a really nice job with the way they recognized him before that game. And did you see Alex Burrows on the broadcast? They showed the highlight. Antoine Roussel, of course they're going to ask for him. Randeep Janda, who hosts Reach Deep in the afternoon, he's doing the in-between period interviews, the intermission interview. And Antoine Roussel, of course he's the guy they're going to ask for after that opening period. He comes out, and before they can get that interview on air, Alex Burrows goes, makes sure he has a big hug with Antoine Roussel. He was pretty pumped for his guy. Really pumped for his guy last night. That place was pumped. Really great first period for the Vancouver Canucks. Before we get to that, let's hear from Antoine Roussel. First game back, goal in his first shift, win for the Vancouver Canucks. We'll get that audio for you in just 1 second here. It'll be worth the wait. Trust me, it was worth the wait for him. This guy came off a pretty major injury. It's an ACL injury. That's surgery. After a great year last year for the Vancouver Canucks, and he'd waited this long, here's what he had to say.
Oh, it's fun. First shift, first goal. Like, yeah, it's awesome. I mean, like, it takes a lot of pressure off my shoulder. Like, I mean, I still have a long road to play perfect hockey yet, but it's a step in the right direction.
Yeah, it's a step in the right direction, all right. He talked about his mentor, Alex Burrows. Did you see what he did? It was very Burrows-esque. Very Burrows-esque what he did last night after he scored the goal. Tapped his heart. Pointed up to the place in the upper bowl there around the ring of the building, the ring of honor, where they had just put up the likeness of Alex Burrows. He pointed at him. He touched his heart. It hit a great note last night, much in the same way that Alex Burrows, who had become the pulse of the team, and it's why he emotionally connected so much with this city, the way he shot the arrow for Luc Bourdon, the way that tribute lasted. Antoine Roussel picking up that torch to a certain degree and running with it here in Vancouver last night. Not a perfect game by the Vancouver Canucks by any stretch of the imagination. The first period was about as good as it's going to get. Not going to have many openers like that. Certainly argue that's their best opening 20 minutes of the season. There's not a lot of others that you would put into the conversation. Maybe you like the start against LA. Last night was great. 4-0 out of the gates for the Vancouver Canucks. And he was right there. Very prominent. We'll talk about the other guys who scored. The next 40, not great. I will tell you why you shouldn't panic. I'll tell you why you shouldn't read too much into those final 40 minutes as this hour continues. But we're going to check in on a couple of other situations around the National Hockey League while we have the opportunity. We're going to check in with Chicago in just a few minutes. A lot going on there in a variety of capacities. And the same can be said about the New Jersey Devils, who let go of their coach yesterday. They're going to be looking to shake a few things up with the Taylor Hall situation brewing as well. Corey Massasak covers the Devils for The Athletic and joins me now right here on your home of Canucks hockey, Sportsnet 650. Corey, thank you very much for making time today. How are you?
I'm doing pretty well. It's been a busy few days, but otherwise all good.
Yeah, it's going to be a busy few more, I would imagine, with everything going on with Taylor Hall and when's he going to be dealt, how's that going to go down. But let's get to the story of the day, which is John Hines being dismissed yesterday. Why was now the right time for the Devils?
I think the easiest way to say it is that the team sort of forced their hand. I don't think the management team and even a lot of the players necessarily think that this is entirely John Hines' fault the way the season has gone. But the last two games were just, I mean, it was a 4-0 loss at home to the biggest rival, where they went 0-for-8 on the power play and gave up 2 shorthanded goals. It was just a really sort of toxic scene at the Rock on Saturday. And then, it was 5-0 by the end of the first period in Buffalo. And as Ray Shiro put it yesterday, the game against the Rangers was bad, and then the game in Buffalo was, I don't have the words to describe that. So that was kind of the, you know, I mean, I've covered one other coach getting fired, and that was in Washington, D.C., and the two games leading up to Glenn Hanlon being let go for Bruce Boudreau were almost exactly the same, except they were both at home. It was like 5-1, 6-1. Everybody kind of knew it by the end of that night that it was, you know, the writing was on the wall.
There was so much optimism for this team over the course of the summer. They trade for P.K. Subban. They bring in Wayne Simmonds. They get Jack Hughes first overall in the draft. What's been the biggest problem?
The biggest problem has been the goaltending. It's an extended list of issues, but I would say that's probably the thing that goes at the top. They just, over the last 2 years, really, they have not had anywhere near what you would consider consistent goaltending. Corey Schneider had a very, like a short window at the end of last season where it seemed like he had sort of found himself again. And the combination of him and Mackenzie Blackwood playing well, there was like a 20-game stretch in there where it was like, hey, this is what this team looks like whenever they have competent goaltending. But, I mean, Corey had a really bad start to the season and is now in the AHL. And Mackenzie Blackwood is a 22-year-old kid who has been sort of, you know, up and down. And so that's the biggest thing. But then, honestly, again, to kind of go back to what Ray said yesterday, he believes that there are 23 guys on the roster who have not even met expectations, let alone having a single guy on the roster who would, you could say, has gone surpassed them, which is pretty rare to happen for an NHL team.
Interesting times in New Jersey for the Devils. Taylor Hall on the block. Corey Massasak of The Athletic joins me to talk about it. And yes, Taylor Hall is the big conversation piece right now. I know they're gauging interest on the market. What do they need to get back in a Taylor Hall deal?
Yeah, that's sort of the next question that comes from all this. I mean, to me, if you're trading a player of that caliber, you have to get the best players and prospects and picks that you can get. Like, I mean, yeah, they could use another young defense. They could use any kind of young defenseman really to sort of build around with. They have one really good young defenseman in Ty Smith, but they could certainly use another one. They could use you could probably say they could use a goaltender, a young goaltender that they would think has a higher ceiling than Mackenzie Blackwood, or somebody to just pair with Mackenzie Blackwood to maybe solve the goaltending issues. But to be honest, the minute they trade Taylor Hall, they're going to need a first line, you know, play driving star forward too, to go along with, they think they have two of those moving forward with Jack Hughes and Nico Hischier, but just having two of those probably isn't going to be enough. So, I mean, honestly, I think it's going to be, I'm sure Ray Shiro is going to shop around as much as he can and try to find the best deal that he can find. And because there's just several holes on this roster if you're looking ahead over the next 2 or 3 years, and they're not going to fill them with one move, but and they're going to add another hole by trading Taylor Hall.
What's the view on P.K. Subban, his role on this team as it moves forward and as it tries to revamp?
Yeah, he'll be one of the guys. I'm sure everybody's going to be watching Taylor's every move until something happens, but I really think he's sort of the key to whether or not this is going to be a turn this around and be competitive again next year, or if this is going to take a while. He's one of the most expensive players in the league. They brought him in to be, you know, sort of the key piece at the top of their defense corps. And, you know, just looking at the last couple games, he's had games where he's been only played the fourth most minutes out of the defenseman. He has 2 goals and 5 points on the season. And, you know, there's certain games where it's like, man, that's vintage PK right there. But then there's also been other games where it hasn't been that. So, he's one of the guys that, given the coaching change, and I don't think anybody thinks Elaine Nazardine is going to rip up the system and start over or do anything drastic. But I'm just interested to see if PK just plays better more consistently after the coaching change.
As you can imagine, here in Vancouver, there's always interest in Corey Schneider. People keep an eye on that. And with Quinn Hughes playing here, they always keep an eye on Jack Hughes as well. How would you characterize his development in his rookie campaign?
Yeah, I think I mean, if you know, I know what Ray was saying yesterday about how there's 23 guys who haven't met expectations. I think Jack and Kyle Palmieri are probably two of the guys that are as close to it as anybody. You know, he does not have as many points as his brother. But he does. You know, he's been actually one of the team's more consistent players, probably from say let's game 7 to game 20 or so. Like he was, you could see it coming. You could see him, you know, creating chances. It didn't matter. He played a few games with Taylor Hall and Kyle Palmieri, and then he played some other games on a different line. He wasn't codependent on other people to sort of make the offense for him. And then he got hurt, and he's missed the last, I think it's either 3 or 4 games now. He's blocked the shot, and he's got something going on with one of his legs. One of the developments is also, too, that he's been living with Corey Schneider since the start of the season, but with Corey and Binghamton for to be determined how long, he looks like he's probably going to move out and get his own place.
Well, he'll find his place in this league. It just might take more time, but that's certainly a way we could talk about the Devils as well, as they were expected to be one of the risers in that division this year. Corey, thank you very much for your time. Look forward to talking again soon.
Yeah, thanks. Anytime.
That's Corey Massasek of The Athletic. He's absolutely right about PK Subban and the point he made there. Subban is going to be a central figure in whether or not the Devils are relatively competitive next year or not. When you look at that roster, there's a lot of young guys and there's a few old guys and there's some prominent old guys. And when I say old, I mean relative to the league. And I put Taylor Hall in that mix. Late 20s, relative to what they have on the bottom end of their roster in the likes of Nico Hischier and Jack Hughes, Ty Smith coming in the next couple of years. Yeah, Taylor Hall feels like he's closer to the PK Subbans, the Wayne Simmonds of the world. Well, Wayne Simmonds, just a 1-year deal. That's easy. You can move off of that. Okay, it didn't work out. We're not as far ahead as we wanted to be. Travis Zajac, he's 34. They've got him on the books for another season. Does somebody want him for the final year of that contract? He's been a guy who's been there forever. So maybe they just want to keep him around. Maybe he's a mentor moving forward. Maybe in the middle of next season, they look at moving Travis Zajac to a contender if that's the way it goes. Subban's there for the next couple of years beyond this one, and he's there at $9 million freight. So that's not easy money to move out. We all know that. Big contracts, tough to move. So can Subban get back to being a guy that drives things from the back end? He's not been awful all year, but he hasn't been as impactful as they believed he was going to be. But that's the guy who's going to really help determine, plus the goaltending, however they fix that, if they can fix that. Do you make sure you get some piece of the goaltending back in a Taylor Hall deal? Or do you simply say, good goalies, you can kind of find them anywhere, including free agency, and we can go with the maybe this will work plan, get a couple of guys who can play 40 games, let them compete. Can you do that? Not a lot of solutions that are easy to explain in New Jersey. And perhaps that's the same situation in Chicago as we turn our attention there now. The Blackhawks had a nice little run, got themselves a couple game over 500, I should say. Not so much now. They've fallen back down, and they are where a lot of people thought they were going to be for most of this season in the Western Conference. Ben Pope with the Chicago Sun-Times covers the Blackhawks, and he joins us now to talk about them. Ben, thank you very much for doing this. How are you?
I'm great. Here in Boston, ready for another game tomorrow, and hopefully it goes a little better than the past few.
Not the easiest place to go get that W, is it?
No. Certainly, I mean, they haven't lost in regulation at home, so it's been a brutal stretch schedule-wise for the Blackhawks, and it's not going to get any easier, at least until we get to New Jersey on Friday.
What's the view of this team that everybody knows about the core and what they did in the 3 Stanley Cups and how highly paid they are? And they've tried to change a lot of the parts. They've moved around a lot of the deck chairs around those guys. They're middling. Are they expected to be that the rest of the year?
I think a lot of people in Chicago came in with sort of tempered optimism for this season, even if nationally that wasn't shared. The Blackhawks are one of the most active teams this offseason, and while it wasn't bringing in star guys, the thought was that they'd improve their depth on offense and improve the defense a bit and brought in one of the better goalies in the league and Robin Lehner, and that all the pieces added up, it could make for a bubble team that could maybe get into a wild card spot or something. and it just hasn't clicked so far. And it's more that the existing pieces haven't produced the way we're used to. Alex DeBrincat has been snake bitten for weeks now. Jonathan Toews only has a couple even strength goals this season. And other than Patrick Kane, a lot of the core guys just aren't living up to expectations. Duncan Keith is hurt now, and that's certainly taken a toll these past few games. So while some of the summer additions have worked out decently well, it just hasn't come together the way a lot of people thought it would.
Given Jonathan Toews' game, I don't think it's terribly surprising that he hasn't been offensively great this year. He had a really nice season last year offensively, at least as far as the point production goes. But Jonathan Toews, it's the intangibles, and we always talk about that with him. The guy who's the biggest surprise to me is Alex DeBrincat. What's going on there? He scored 41 a year ago, just 5 so far this season.
Well, I think luck is certainly playing a part of it. He's hit some posts lately, and he even got a fight in Colorado last weekend because he was so frustrated about missing an open net. But it's also his shot generation is down. He's just not getting as many opportunities, and I think it's a bit of a confidence issue with him. This is only his third year in the league, and he's still a young guy, and things have gone so perfectly, really, his first 2 years individually. And now this is his first real long stretch of adversity. And I think he'll break out of it eventually, and he's due for some regression at some point. But it's definitely concerning to see the way he's struggling right now.
Ben Pope of the Chicago Sun-Times joining me here on your home of hockey in Vancouver, Sportsnet 650, talking about the Blackhawks. You mentioned how active the Blackhawks were in the offseason via trade, free agency. They brought in a bunch of new faces. What can they do now? Is there any rearranging to be done? Are there trades that are obvious to you that they should be looking to make?
Well, I think the front office needs to make a decision, and it might not be immediately, but sometime before we get to March, on whether they're going to keep trying to fill in the gaps in this aging team and keep it in the playoff conversation, or whether they're going to blow it up. And if they blow it up, I mean, all hell's going to break loose, because there's a lot of old core pieces that have been here for a while, and things could get really crazy. If they keep trying to contend, then I could think we could see some small trades. Certainly Sam Bowman has been pretty aggressive in trying to retool this roster, and I don't think that's going to change anytime soon, but it's going to take a significant improvement to get this team back in the playoff picture. I mean, they're only a point out of last in the West, so there's going to need to be a big turnaround in some aspect.
You mentioned bringing in Robin Lehner. It was just the one-year deal. I know Corey Crawford holds a special place in that organization. Lehner's been the better goalie overall, despite his comments about shootouts and how he can't stand him and how he's just not good in them. Why hasn't he played more?
Well, I think you're right that there's definitely some franchise respect for Crawford. And I think Jeremy Colleton, given that he's still so new as coach, might be a little afraid to upset that and go against it. And I think there might be some instruction from above as well to keep it on sort of an even rotation. But it's perplexing to me, too. And I think we could see, as time goes on and if the team continues to struggle, that they are willing to get a little more radical and maybe play Lehner more than they initially planned out in the training camp, just because that's what it's going to take to get this team back in contention. But I think his honesty and his blunt remarks aren't part of it. The team seems pretty on board with that, and while it's maybe not what we expect from players, he hasn't been disrespectful or overly critical of the team. I think he's just said what everyone else is thinking, so I don't think that's part of it. I think it's more of a sort of a strategy that maybe could be changing soon.
These questions all pertain to the on-ice product, which hasn't been great, but the backdrop of all of this is what is happening in hockey right now, the conversation around coaching and conduct around players. And there are two situations that involve the Blackhawks to a certain extent. Mark Crawford is currently assistant coach with the team, despite the fact he's away from them. The allegations didn't occur with Chicago, but he's on staff there. Bill Peters was obviously part of the Rockford IceHogs when the Akeem Elu allegations, which have been confirmed, took place. How is all of that being viewed right now when fans and media talk about the Blackhawks in Chicago?
Well, as of a few days ago, it seemed like they'd managed to dodge most of the mud with the Bill Peters situation. They claimed that the front office didn't know about any of this and didn't sort of take it into account when deciding to trade Alou away in the 2010 offseason. And it seems like that's been sort of confirmed, or at least there isn't really any proof that they were aware of it. So they managed to get off pretty clean from that, even though it's certainly an unfortunate situation and one that could have gotten a lot uglier for the franchise than it did. I think the Mark Crawford story in the past few days has really become a much bigger concern. He was supposed to be the experienced guy who could bring his veteran experience and more worldly NHL coaching perspective to what's an extremely young coaching staff, not just with Jeremy Colliton, but also the other assistants. But now he's away from the team, and this is more of a distraction than anything. Colliton, for what it's worth, said that Crawford's been great with the team and that there hasn't been anything concerning that he's done here, but certainly these allegations are being taken seriously and are very concerning to see, and this could be an interesting story as it goes along. I think his future is definitely in doubt, it's safe to say.
Yeah, I think that's safe to say as well. Ben, thank you very much for your time, getting us up to speed on what's going on with the Chicago Blackhawks. Look forward to doing this again at some point in the very near future.
Thank you.
That is Ben Pope with the Chicago Sun-Times. And both of the incidents that are being talked about in the hockey world, or both of the people in question in the hockey world, Bill Peters, Mark Crawford, they are among them. They have ties to the Blackhawks organization in a variety of capacities. And we're not sure exactly where the Mark Crawford conversation is going, I should say. But as recently as yesterday, Harold Drucken, former Vancouver Canuck, made some very strong accusations against Crawford yesterday. People are going to be continually asked about him and when some of this stuff happened. Patrick O'Sullivan among those. Bill Peters, should they have known in Chicago? Hard to know. Hard to know. It's their affiliate, but this is a story that's been under wraps for 10 years. I don't blame Alou for that at all. I know some people do. I am not among them. I have zero problem with the timing of this. It's his story, and if he chose now to share it, so be it. That's up to him. Doesn't change what was done. And that's the focal point. Really interesting times in Chicago. The shine has come off that organization in a variety of capacities. There are contracts they'd like to move on from as far as the current hockey team goes. And there are heartstrings in the community that don't want them to move on for some of those players, that want them there for the entirety of the deal. As Ben said, there are big decisions that need to be made, philosophical decisions that need to be made about that organization, because all of the other tinkering they did doesn't appear to have amounted to enough. They're a team that looks like an also-ran in the Western Conference, and at what point do you start to actually turn the page? Some great updates from New Jersey, Chicago. We'll get to the Vancouver Canucks next. There was a lot to be concerned about over the last 40 minutes when it comes to the Canucks, especially the second period. I'll tell you next why you shouldn't panic. It's the Scott Rentoul Show on your home with the Vancouver Canucks, Sportsnet 650.
Now more of the Scott Rentoul Show on the official home of the Canucks, Sportsnet 650.
Miller will carry up the boards, switches places with Pettersson, and Miller through the middle, goes left circle. Besser with time and space through it to the goal. Tip, they score! Elias Pettersson, parked at the top of the crease, tips it past Nielsen on the glove side. And the Canucks are up 3-0 with 6:02 left in the first.
Life was good then, wasn't it? Life was good right then for the Vancouver Canucks. Scott Rentoul here. Thanks for joining me this morning. A morning after the Canucks take care of the Ottawa Senators, though the final score makes it seem a lot easier than it ended up being. Want your comments on that? You can hit me up on the Subway text line 650-650. Before we get to last night, some good news and some bad news regarding the blue line for the Vancouver Canucks. The bad news first. You heard it last night. It's Alex Edler. He'll be reevaluated in 2 weeks, lower body injury. I don't think anyone could be surprised at that, given the recent injury history of Alex Edler over the last number of seasons, and also given the fact that he's played a lot this year, he's been injured a couple of times, this latest setback, one that's going to take a little longer to deal with. The other news, much more positive for the Vancouver Canucks, and that has to do with the health of Olli Juolevi. Here's what Jim Benning stated today. They sent this out on social media. Olli Juolevi recently developed hip soreness and was removed from Utica's active roster as a precautionary measure. After further evaluation, it was determined that he is fit to return to play. Medical staff will continue a course of conservative treatment and closely monitor Juolevi's status. So that's good news. He's going to be back on the ice, and you can understand the concern when he gets hip pain for a couple of reasons. One, this is a guy coming off a major knee injury. So does it have something to do with that? That's the most recent injury on record. Number two, what's the injury before that one? And this is where the greater concern comes in if you're a Canucks fan. And as mentioned, the Canucks are saying he's going to be back on the ice soon. They're going to continue to monitor his status, every precaution taken. But the injury prior to the knee injury is the back injury. And so what do you worry about when you hear hip pain? Whether this is fair or not, it's a logical conclusion for somebody who cares about the situation. You hear hip pain, you think, is that related to something in his back? Is that a nerve? Is it something along those lines? I don't know. I'm not sure we're going to get those details from the Vancouver Canucks, but I understand the concern. So I understand the concern on the Canucks part as well. Maybe we're being overly cautious here, but for a young man who's had a couple of tough injuries over the last couple of years, we hear hip pain. He keeps saying it's not going away. It's lingering. We better get this thing checked out. We better make sure that we're not seeing a form of regression in one of those injuries. It's good news that he's fit enough to get back on the ice. We'll see when he gets back into the lineup. I understand all of the concern from both the fan base and from the organization. So it's good news, even though people will walk lightly. They will tread very lightly when it comes to the injury status of Olli Juolevi. As mentioned, good times in the arena last night. I was there. It's Alex Burrow's night. He is saluted before the game. Really nice video involving Daniel and Henrik doing the narration. It was touching. Alex Burrow spoke. He was fantastic. He hit every note from thanking his teammates, the way he came up through the organization. He talked about his family. He singled out the Sedins. He talked about Ryan Kesler, Kevin Bieksa, the most competitive people he'd ever played with. He obviously paid tribute to his wife and his kids who were there on the ice with him, and then he hit the fan base. Saved that one for last, about how he always knew, in good times or bad, that the Vancouver fan base had his back. It was a really touching tribute. It was really well handled by the Canucks and Alex Burrows, and the fans were loving it. As mentioned, I was in the stands last night, so I got to see it firsthand. And boy, did the team feed off of that. What a start. What a start. Antoine Roussel comes out on his first shift. I, like probably most of you, had my eyes fixated on him. I didn't even really look at his line mates. I wanted to see if he was going to throw a hit. I wanted to see how he was going to install himself in that game last night. And he went looking for one behind the net, didn't deliver it. And I thought, he just wants to make sure it's the right time. Maybe he doesn't want to take a penalty. The very next thing he did, finishes a check along the boards. Gets a rousing, a round of applause for that. And very quickly after that happened, there's the turnover. It's Adam Gaudette breaking down the wing, and it's Roussel. It's the back end. He scores, and everything's going well. And then they explode for three more goals in that opening frame. And they did what they should do on a night filled with emotion because of Alex Burrows, because of Antoine Roussel coming back in the lineup, and because of the competition, quite frankly. I know about parity. We all do. The Ottawa Senators aren't a great team. I know that's a revelation to everybody out there. It doesn't mean you're going to beat them each and every time out, but the first period, that's the Canucks doing what they should have done. And it's great that some guys who aren't normally in on the act are getting involved. Chris Tanev had a couple of assists, and they were pretty nice, especially the first one. The feed to Tanner Pearson on the doorstep was great. Elias Pettersson, that power play goal just looked perfect. It's exactly how you draw it up, and Pettersson's reaction to me spoke volumes. Man, perfect pass from Besser. I just put myself in the right situation. I don't need to rub this in. We're up 3-0. That's as good as it gets, boys. And then Zach MacEwen gets his first NHL goal. The place is going nuts. So much energy in the building. You're thinking, how many are they going to get tonight? And then it got really tough. And then it got really tough for a couple of reasons. One of them being the Vancouver Canucks probably felt the same way the fan base did. All right, here we go, 4-0. That team's probably packing it in. They're not very good. It's a stat patter night. Turns out the Ottawa Senators didn't want to pack it in. Turns out that while they may be devoid of some of the talent of some of the better clubs around the NHL right now as they strive to develop some of their young players, turns out they aren't quitters. Turns out they still want to play hockey. And hockey they played in that second period. The Canucks were no good. They were sloppy. There were turnovers all over the place. Defensive zone coverage was lacking. They weren't generating much at the other end. Ottawa continued to press. And let's be frank about this. The Canucks were lucky to be in the situation they were after two periods, which was up 4-1. Remember, Ottawa, early power play, they get denied a goal because the whistle went when the puck wasn't covered up. Canucks get away with one there. There's the opening goal that wasn't for the Ottawa Senators. Second period, ultra sloppy. 9 high danger chances against in the second period, and Ottawa only made the Canucks pay on one occasion. Thatcher Demko made some great saves. Made a breakaway save. Made another left pad save that I think was his best of the night. So they're up 4-1 heading into the third period, and they weren't as bad in the third as they were in the second. They weren't great. It's not as though they closed that game out with an extreme amount of confidence. But here's why you shouldn't panic. Even though it took an overruled goal because of offside, and the Canucks skate away with a 5-2 victory, there are times in a season where all you need is the win, that the result is actually more important. And that's last night for the Vancouver Canucks. They were great off the hop. They put it in cruise control to a certain extent. It was nowhere near a 60-minute effort, but it was more about taking care of those 2 points last night, putting them on the board, not losing ground in a situation where you have no business losing ground. That was more important. Now this team needs a little rest. They just got back from what was a 6-game road trip, but felt like a 7-game road trip because they played back-to-back on the weekend against the Oilers. 2 days later, they're still catching up when it comes to rest. And then there is the human nature component of last night, which is we're up by a whole bunch. We're up by a lot. This is going to be easy. They let their foot off the gas. Don't panic. That was more about getting the W last night than it was about style points. And there were a lot of them in the first period. So what would Travis Green say after that? This is a guy that has taken them to task when they're not good enough. How did the head coach sound? Have a listen.
You know, the people from the outside, it's hard. I shouldn't say hard, but we have a young group. You're up 4-0. You know, and the way we play and the way we need to play to have success is we have to have urgency in our game. When you have urgency in your game, you skate your hardest, you get to places, you go through bodies when you need to, you stop on pucks. And when you slip a little bit and your urgency level isn't quite as high, you know, you start poking, you start reaching, you don't skate quite as hard, you're a half second behind. And, you know, it wasn't our best period, but definitely we weren't terrible. But it's such a fine line between playing well and not playing well. It can change fast. And it's happened in the league a lot. And I think that's part of it, because when you're not quite as urgent, the speed of the game is so fast, the other team doesn't stop playing. They're going to compete just as hard, and if you let your level down a little bit, the line really changes. And it's such a fine line between scoring and not scoring that if that dips a little bit, you can be on your heels.
That's Travis Green. I wondered what he was going to say. I believe he took the right tact after that game. I think he did the right thing. There is a time to hold your team accountable and to say, I know we won, but last night wasn't that time. You've got to be able to play different cards. Travis Green's smart enough to know that. I know there are people who are down on Travis Green. They don't like the messaging. They don't like some of the tactics he employs as far as lineup deployment, player deployment, all of those things. I think he's handled this situation extremely well, and I thought last night was another feather in his cap. Not the right time to go after them. There are going to be other times. There are going to be times when the Canucks win a game and Travis Green has to say, not good enough. Not good enough if we're going to be a team that competes for a playoff spot. If we're a team that's in the playoffs, not good enough. Last night wasn't that night. Last night was these guys are a little tired. They're a little wiped out. They need a little rest, both physically and emotionally right now. Big picture, they got the 2 points. Areas to clean up, sure. But go away for a day, guys. Go get some rest, and then we'll get back at this. It's going to be a weird scene on Saturday. Not used to playing a 1 o'clock game at home at Rogers Arena. And they'll do that against the Buffalo Sabres. Start to dial that in later in the week. Just give them a little bit of rest right now. Ease off as far as the head coach goes. I think he employed the right tactic after the game. You can hit me up, Subway text line, if you agree, disagree. What happened to the Houston Rockets last night? I know that's a weird turn, but did you see this play? James Harden dunked a ball, and he dunked it so hard that the bottom of the net and the spin on the ball snapped it around so that it went back up over top of the rim, bounced off the back of the rim and out, but the ball had already gone through. They didn't count it because it happened so fast. And then when they had a chance to look at it again, they didn't count it then either. So Houston blows a lead in the fourth quarter against the Spurs, goes to double overtime and loses. And now they have to figure out what to do. They're appealing the result, as you should. Now, we've seen it in hockey in the past before we had review, before there was a command center. And this to me is, why doesn't basketball have something exactly like this? You wouldn't have to use it very often, but this is obvious. It's an obvious and egregious error. The man scored, and you took it away. We used to see this in hockey. You'd find out later in the game, you'd find out a period later, that puck actually went through the twine, or it hit the back bar and came out. Man, that sucks for them. Boy, the score should be this right now, but there was no mechanism in place to reverse it. Now, somebody from Toronto makes a call. Guys, that puck went in. We're looking at the situation. We're going to put time back on the clock. We're going to put the goal on the board. That's how it goes. Didn't happen last night in Houston, so they're protesting this game. They're trying to figure out what to do. Jamie, you said it earlier in the show. They're going to have to replay a part of this game. I think it's the only way around it. I know that they blew the lead. I know that they lost in double overtime. You can't just award them the win and assume the rest of the game goes the same way, plus 2 points. You can't do that if you're the NBA. And at the same time, this was an obvious score that was missed by the officials. I think they're going to have to replay the end of this game.
And there's precedent for it specifically in the NBA. They've done it before, and I don't think it was as big a chunk of time the last time they did it. Like, this would be 8 minutes.
I think it was 51 seconds when Shaq, right, they incorrectly assigned a foul in that game.
So it's a little different, but the precedent is there. And it's so fundamental. It's not a judgment call. It's not supposed to be a judgment call whether or not the ball went through the hoop. It happened, and it just was recorded incorrectly. I don't really see another option. They're going to have to, at the next time the Rockets and the Spurs play, they're going to have to put, you know, 7:51 or whatever on the clock before the opening tip of that game and play out the remainder of this game.
You are Judge Jamie. You have ruled. We do it every Wednesday. I uphold your ruling. That is Judge Jamie weighing in. While we're talking hoops, I wanted to get you this audio. Carl English was on with me last hour. He was fantastic. Longtime player for Canada. He's 38 years old now. You may remember him at the University of Hawaii if you're an old hoops fan like I am. He could shoot, man. He could fill it up. Never quite made it to the NBA. He's got a book out right now. It's called Chasing the Dream. It's about the trials and tribulations of a young man who lost his parents when he was 5 years old, got split up from his siblings, threw himself into basketball to escape from the harsh reality that life had dealt him. And it looks like a compelling read. And he was on to talk about that. And we worked our way around to participation with the national team, something he did a lot, but understands why some guys don't choose. And he wanted to give multiple perspectives. He's a great guy to speak about it. We're all passionate about having our athletes come out and wear the maple leaf. Here's Carl English on the decision to play or not to play for Team Canada.
Well, let's for the record say that everybody wants to play. Everybody wants to play for Canada unless at an early age they were done wrong by somebody and they're like, oh, this. But other than that, everybody wants to play. The thing that comes into effect, and it always came into effect with us, and then it really affected me, is the insurance. Insurance is a big issue when you play for your country because you're putting everything on the line. So you come in and it's not about giving up your summers. It's not about giving up your time. It's not about whether you want to play or not want to play. It's the fear of the injury and the insurance to cover your injuries. And then it's also your situation, and everybody has a different one. Like, we take Tristan right now coming in. Well, he's going into a free agency. You know, maybe Kelly, I think Kelly's going into a contract as well, or no?
No, he's still got time left on his deal.
Okay, Kelly, but now we look at Kelly firsthand because, you know, I've worked with him and know him personally. And you look at Kelly, well, Kelly's always eager to play, but I bet he second guesses it now because he messed up his knee and he was 3 months behind. So now you go into, right now he's only playing the basketball, right now he's playing the basketball that he should have played at the start of the season. But because of the knee, he was behind, and you sit on the bench. So now you take it if it's – I went on the record as well as saying, if you're a franchise, there's a better chance to have a franchise-type player to play because everybody's going to do everything for that guy, right? Everybody's going to protect him. Everybody's going to make sure that he's – that if something goes wrong, that he will get back. But I know the stuff that happened with Paul George scared everybody. But now you take a guy that's – let's say you're a 12th man, and you're working to try to get into that rotation. Well, that team might want you there all summer, showing that you're putting in the work, working with the coach every day, because that gives them trust in you. Let's say you're a 15th man and you're working for that spot. Well, they want you around, and that's money. And then let's say you're a 7th or 8th man and you're trying to get a starting job. Well, you want to show them you're committed to the organization and you're doing everything possible. Now, let's say you're either one of those guys I just mentioned, and you go in there and you get hurt and you miss 6 months. Where do you think you're going to be? If you're the 15th man, you're not on the team. If you're the 12th man fighting for rotation, you're at the end of the bench or probably in the D-League. If you're the 7th or 8th man that was fighting for the starting job, now you're at the end of the bench trying to get into the rotation. This is what people don't understand. We're all selfish in the sense that we want them to play. I want them to play. I truly believe that if they all played, and this is the passion in me coming out, I truly believe if they all played, we'd be a medal and a contender. And I'm not talking about, I'm saying to win it all. That's how good of the talent pool that we have right now. Depending on who the Americans send, they're up in the top three, top two in the world, right? And I've gone on the record, and I think if you're following it, you will agree with me. Is that true fact, right?
I agree.
Yeah. So, but now it's the other aspect of that. When I played in 2012, and it's in my book, I got hurt. I got hurt with Team Canada, and I tore my tricep. I there was insurance in place, but that insurance didn't cover me. I'm still fighting it to this day for that money. But not only that, I was insured for a nice bit of money, but I had $1 million-plus contract on the table that I lost. So I know firsthand what that means. And those guys call me, and if the insurance is in place and it protects them, and even then when it's insurance, like it was, it never protected me. So it's a gamble for these guys. It's a huge gamble, and we all can be selfish. Say, oh, everybody kills Andrew. Everybody kills the guys that don't play. There's so many more things that affects it. You know, what if your GM don't want you to play, right? But he don't publicly want to come out and say it. Well, guess what? He's your employer. You're not going to go against them, right? Like, yeah, you might go against your agent, but you're not going to go against your team. What if your coach don't want you to play? No, I want you here. We're going to develop all these things because I see you as a huge player that's going to make a run for us in the playoffs. Now, the other part is it's in the end of June. What happens if Jamal or one of these guys make a deep run and they go right up till the middle or first week of June? You tell me Denver's going to want him to turn around and go straight after playing 100 games to go straight to play? Hey, you guys gotta understand the game a little bit if you guys think that. So that's my insight on it. I can talk for this for weeks because I know the good and I know the bad. And I've always played. I've always sacrificed for my country, and it's a greatest pleasure for me to put the jersey on. But then I also know what it means like to get hurt and then the effects of that and then the effects of Canada basketball not having my back. So these are the other things that people don't understand, you know, and I know it's business and I get all the other stuff that comes with it, but it's a tough place to expect these kids to come out and play and risk millions of dollars if the things ain't in place to protect them. And then even if it's fighting, like if you're not in the right place, the NBA is very fickle. Like I said, if you're one of those guys that's fighting for those key roles, well, then you got to be there with the team and they got to see you. Coaches love that.
And it's also the relationship that you build with the coach. If you work out with your coach for 4 months, well, guess what? He's going to trust you a lot more than the guy that he never worked out with at all. So these are things to take into consideration when guys don't play. And it's hard for us and all of Canada and all the media, because everybody wants them to play because we're so proud of where we are and we're so proud of what we could be. And we're all disappointed when they don't come out because it's frustrating. And I get that. And I'm the same way. But I'm also passionate for these guys as well.
That is a very fair and balanced take from Carl English on players suiting up for our national program. Extremely fair. And I would conclude by saying this. If we're going to demand these guys put on the Maple Leaf, suit up for Canada like we all have, myself included, we need to demand they are protected properly. That if they are going to put their careers on the line to a certain degree, they are properly insured. I don't want to hear stories about guys suiting up for this country, women suiting up for this country, having injuries and then not being covered and having claims not go through. If they're going to put their livelihoods on the line to suit up for us, let's protect them properly. We have to demand that as fans of the sport. That is a very fair take from Carl English. Great interview with him. Looking forward to talking Canucks with you now. Canucks Central is up next. Bick Nizar joins me in studio after last night's 5-2 win. What stood out on a night that was extremely reflective of Alex Burrows, and it wasn't just Antoine Roussel? We'll explain next, right here on your home of hockey, Sportsnet 650.